Members, we're going to call the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform to order. We have a quorum present, so our first order of business will be to move the minutes for both March 6th and March 10th. Do I have a motion to move the minutes?
So moved.
Representative Moran moves the minutes for March 6th and March 10th. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Members, we have Representative Hamilton's bill up first. I am going to turn the gavel over to our vice chair. I have to go present a bill downstairs briefly, and then we'll be back up. And so with that, I'll have Representative Peterson come. And Representative Hamilton, if you want to start presenting your bill, and I will actually get your bill moved. And so I will move that House File 975 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections. Representative Hamilton, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. This bill deals with the State Quality Council, and as we know, it's charged with improving the state system for ensuring services for persons with disabilities at the highest quality possible. And the council did receive startup funds in 2011, but was not funded in 2013, yet it continues to be supported by DHS over the past 2 years. And with that, Madam Chair and committee members, what I'd like to do is turn it over to our testifiers to walk us through the bill, if that's okay.
Absolutely. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's Lance Hegland, and I'm a co-chair for the Minnesota State Quality Council. And this bill is creates some regional councils, three additional regional councils, starting this year, and then next year creating an additional three regional councils, and as it's aside the budget needed to do that work. And I'm strongly supporting House File 975. Currently, when my personal care agency enrolls as a state provider, Minnesota checks to make sure it meets minimum standards. So, do they have adequate policies and procedures in place? Do they have sufficient administrative staff? But this check merely ensures that the provider has some of the tools and blueprints necessary to for quality services at that particular moment. But how do we know these resources are actually producing quality over a given period of time? And we really don't. Our current quality assurance system doesn't maximize public value. For example, how would Minnesota know that I've experienced more dehydration, more digestive challenges, and more skin breakdown over the past year? My voice is currently unheard. How would Minnesota know it's been more difficult for me to work and to contribute to our communities? Again, my voice is currently unheard. And how would Minnesota know that these symptoms have increased my use of clinical services and pharmaceuticals? Again, my voice is currently unheard. And how would Minnesota know if other individuals and families are experiencing similar symptoms? Their voices are unheard too. And so how would we know if quality is decreasing even though public spending is remaining constant? And it wouldn't right now. So as a result, we wouldn't know when or what to investigate. We're prevented from discovering that there actually exists a strong correlation between these symptoms and increased worker turnover and a growing shortage of workers. Maybe we'd find out in a year or two when we do our biannual surveys, but in the meantime, we've wasted a lot of opportunities to improve quality and a wasted opportunity to increase public value. Minnesota needs to hear the voices of individuals and families more frequently. We need to be more responsive to the feedback we're actually gathering, and we need to more proactively seize opportunities to improve quality and public value. Bottom line, House File 975 is an investment in quality assurance to help us monitor performance trends. It more quickly triggers a response when we're not getting the intended results, it better ensures public value. House File 975 is an investment to seize opportunities to improve and sustain quality disability support services. House File 975 is an investment in public stewardship. Thank you, and now I'll turn it over to Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, and thank you, Madam Chair. I do have one other testifier, if I could, please.
Welcome to the committee, and please proceed.
Yes. Hello, Madam and committee members. I'm very, very happy to be here. My name is Kurt Watson with the Arc of Minnesota. I'd like to say thank you so, so very, very much for this opportunity to speak with you. I want to speak in favor of the State Quality Council, House File 975. I think for people's voices to be heard, this really, really needs to be in place, because the other programs just have check marks and such, and they don't focus on the person. I would really like to see the State Quality Council funded. I'd like to speak on Region 10, also the voice rebuilds along with this in southeastern Minnesota. I was the chair and director of Region 10 for a time when I lived in southeast Minnesota. That program is amazing. It focuses on the person and not on other people and check marks and going in and checking a box and saying, this is okay, this is okay, this is okay. How in the world, people, ask yourself, I want to challenge you, how can that focus on the person? And we go in and to do voice review, we focus on the person. And we have them tell us who they would like us to talk to, either parents or guardians or staff. And then we all come around in a big group meeting and suggest stuff with the individual what he or she wants. The way I like to put it today, you guys, chairman and members of the committee, is just because you and I may like to go to church, or like one kind of pop, why in the world are we making Bobby or Sally or Billy drink the same pop, go to the same church we do? Like it or not, maybe not in those exact terms, but we get into that rut where we make the people come or go where they don't want to go, whether it's transportation, whatever. Disability people are no different than you and I. If you wanted to buy a house or a car, why would we go to your relatives and ask them, what kind of car does Representative Dean want? Or what kind of house does Tina Lutheran want? Just an example. you would want to make those choices yourself. And why can't they? So in closing, I want to say thank you all very much. We're here to answer any questions, and I appreciate this opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rutson. Are there any other testifiers on this bill or anyone from the audience that would like to share any more testimony? Then any member questions? Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and anyone that would like to answer this. This seems like an awful lot of money for council. Can you please give some details on how the money is spent?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. This is money is being broken out. Some of that is being used just to keep the State Quality Council going because it hasn't been funded for a few years, and the department has been hosting us without any funding. The other part of this is to be used to do some surveys, which are relatively expensive to do, to reach out to people, and those might be done by mail. Some of those might be done in person or over the phone. So it's kind of labor intensive. And then in order to get the other councils going, it will take a lot of resources just to go out and do the recruiting, to get a very diverse group of stakeholders to come together and get them starting to work together and finding a host for them, setting up the policies and procedures. So, but it, like I said earlier, I really believe it's a really good investment for us to be able to be doing the quality improvement to make sure that we're maximizing that public value. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, I'll renew my motion, or I guess it was Representative Mack's motion on House File 975, unless Representative Hamilton, you have any closing remarks?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. This is a way that we can ensure that people with disabilities do have a voice through actually participating, so I strongly ask for your support. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And so this will be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say no. Motion prevails. Thank you, and your bill's on its way. Next, we will have Representative Zerwa for House File 236.
Thank you.
Representative Zerwas, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. At this time, I will move House File 236 to public safety next. And then I have a delete all amendment. So at this time, I'll move the DE1.
All right, Representative Zerwas moves DE1 amendment. Mr. Zerwas, or Representative Zerwas, to the amendment.
Madam Chair, members, that DE1 incorporates the changes in the Senate so far that have been incorporated, plus some additional language, I think, from the Department of Corrections. Since there's still a little bit of concern with the Department of Corrections, and we're going to continue working with them as this moves forward to public safety.
Thank you. Any discussion on the amendment? Then all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say no. And the amendment is adopted. Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Just a brief overview or introduction, and then I'll turn it over to my testifier. The thought process behind this bill is the idea that every Minnesotan deserves the right to try and the right to not give up. And I think as you look at someone that has a terminal diagnosis and how they choose to play out their final time on Earth, there is a movement across the country to give those patients an opportunity in partnership and in consultation with their physician to try some experimental drugs, procedures, or medical devices. And with that brief intro, I'll turn it over to my testifier, and then we'll both be available for questions.
Thank you. Please state your name for the records and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Zerwas. My name is Kurt Altman. I am the National Policy Advisor and General Counsel for the Goldwater Institute. We are based in Phoenix, Arizona. I am one of the drafters of the model legislation that House File 236 is modeled after. I'm here to tell you a little bit about what right to try laws do, what's going on with right to try laws around the country. First of all, what House File 236 does, just like what Representative Zerwas indicated, is it gives people that are diagnosed as terminal, as defined in the bill, the opportunity with the prescription recommendation, frankly, of their physician, their treating physician, gives them the opportunity to try, if necessary, as a last chance, investigational new drugs that have not yet made it to market and completed the entire FDA process. What the law does is it requires the investigational new drug to have passed successfully phase one of the FDA's current process, which is a three-phase testing process. And importantly, it doesn't stop there. What it requires is that the investigational new drug remain in FDA clinical trial and the approval process. If for some reason the investigational new drug were no longer in FDA clinical trials and through the approval application process, then it would no longer be eligible as an investigation, as a drug under right to try. The other things that this law does is essentially it doesn't require a manufacturer to provide the drug. It doesn't require a doctor to recommend a drug in this situation. But what it does require is that a treating physician of a terminal patient, after they've exhausted all of other efforts or at least examined all currently approved FDA medications or devices or biologics for whatever condition it may be, gives that doctor the opportunity to recommend a drug that's going through the investigation process. What that means is the drug is much further along typically than phase one. Often these drugs that are developed, manufactured, researched right here in America take 10 to 15 years to navigate the FDA approval process. Many of them are in use in other parts of the world and not available, or not easily available, I should say, to American citizens and citizens right here in the state of Minnesota. This bill would bring those drugs closer to the people that need them, closer to home. They're typically available. Typically, these drugs are going through clinical trials and clinical trial process. And I've heard around the country, incidentally, this bill, similar bills are running in 29 states currently. It's currently law in it's currently law as of today in seven states around the country. Clinical trials of these drugs are very exclusive. They're very difficult to get into. Only 3% of individuals who are afflicted with whatever condition may be are eligible for clinical trials. I like to say that you can't be too sick to qualify for a clinical trial. You have to be sick enough. You can't have other outside influences that may affect the clinical data, such as high blood pressure, diabetes, something like that. Many things exclude people from clinical trials, so only 3% have the opportunity to work and use these drugs as they're being tested. That leaves 97% of people afflicted with whatever condition it may be that have no choice, have no opportunity to access these drugs. I've been around the country. I've testified in 10 to 15 states, maybe more, frankly. And I've talked to patient groups. I've talked to manufacturers. I've talked to doctors groups, talked to many people. And the continuing theme from patients and folks in this condition, this terminal condition, is a theme of control. What this law doesn't do is guarantee anybody that they're going to be cured. And patients know that. It's not a guarantee, but they also know that it's an opportunity. I'm told over and over again that at this stage in their life, they want to have that control to make the decisions between about their future between them and their physician. And laws like Right to Try and HF 236 give them that opportunity. Give people like Nick Auden, who is a Colorado resident, 41 years old, had melanoma. And he actually was one of the 3% fortunate folks to get into a clinical trial of a new drug that was in clinical phase 3 and was showing significant efficacy. It was called PD-1 at the time. He was married. He had two kids and another one on the way. Well, as soon as he entered the clinical trial, he developed a complication with his condition, which disqualified him from the clinical trial. Unfortunately, because he was unable to access that drug, he died a short time later, leaving a wife and three children. Had Right to Try laws like HF 236 been on the books in Colorado at the time, which incidentally they are on the books now, Nick would have had an opportunity to take this drug, which is now approved and is helping literally millions of people around the country. So that's why these laws are needed, why it's a good law, a good bill. Again, as I indicated, I've been all over the country. I've answered questions. I can talk to this committee about the FDA process, about other ways that they can access medications like this and why this is needed. I don't need to go on and on with stories or any other information. I would open myself up, Madam Chair, to any questions about this, and I think I should be able to answer the committee's concerns, if there are any.
Thank you. Before we go to that, is there anyone else from the audience that would like to testify on this bill? Okay. And, well, first we have Representative Schultz that has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I see that in the bill that anyone who cares for a patient is not liable. Is the state liable at all if we pass this legislation?
Mr. Altman.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative, to answer your question, the state is not liable. Limitation of liability in the law indicates it's a very, very narrow limitation of liability, and what it does is it removes any liability from manufacturers who provide this drug or any medical personnel, frankly, in the course of administering this drug, only for adverse effects of the drug. And combined with this limitation of liability, there's an informed consent that's required to be signed by the patients. And an informed consent that lays out the possibility that this might not work, that it could even hasten their death, that it could have significant side effects. So with that informed consent and the limitation of liability, doctors and manufacturers are not responsible for the adverse effects of the drug. But what that means, actually, is they are not immune from general standards of care, general malpractice. I always use the example of a dirty needle. If they use the dirty needle, that's malpractice. They're not immune from that, just the adverse effects of the drug, and the state is not liable.
The state is this, Representative Schultz. Thank you, Madam Chair. Is the state excluded in that waiver then, or where are they excluded from liability?
Mr. Altman.
Madam Chair, Representative, in the language, it doesn't mention the state because the state is really not a party at this point between the doctor and the manufacturer. Certainly, I don't think there'd be any objection to adding the state to that waiver of liability as well. But the way the law is currently written, I'm not sure that it's necessary because the state is not a party to this transaction, for lack of a better word, between the doctors and the manufacturers and the patients.
Representative Schultz.
Madam Chair, but are we, I mean, if we're responsible, if we're going to put this into state statute, does that exclude us from being a party to that transaction? I would think it would include us in that transaction.
Mr. Altman.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not sure it does include the state. You know, that would be something certainly that this committee would have to determine. But the state is simply authorizing this activity, and the liability and any potential liability that comes from it would be between the parties that are utilizing the law for access. But I certainly understand your point.
Thank you.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Altman, I'm looking at some of the definitions and the definition of terminal illness that you use in the DE1. Is that a definition that has been used in other states? And then also, where this has been passed in other states, which of the states has passed, and how long has this been into effect? Has this been around for a couple of years, or what's the experience?
Mr. Altman.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative, the definition of terminal illness in Section D, what I'm looking at, Representative, is from lines 1.12 to 1.15. Is a common definition, excuse me, that's been used around the country. In fact, I think this definition is verbatim from the state of Virginia's law that has passed, or bill that has passed both houses, is awaiting governor's signature. The terminal illness definitions around the country do differ slightly. They all say what this one does. Some of them are connected to other definitions of terminal illnesses in that respective state's code. Which has already been there, but they all essentially say the exact same thing as this bill does, or this file does, and as I said, this one is primarily modeled after the state of Virginia's. As far as your second question, last year, last session, 2014 session, Arizona, Michigan, Louisiana, Colorado, and Missouri passed right-to-try laws. In fact, Arizona's was passed as a legislative initiative that went to the ballot, so it passed in November at the election, a public election, 80-20. All those laws went into effect. Arizona's went into effect January 1st. All the other laws from last year went into effect late summer, early fall. I can't give you the exact dates. So they are very new, and each state and each institution and institutions within each state are making preparations to utilize this law if it becomes necessary. Just this week, the governor of Arkansas and the governor of Wyoming signed the bills into law that passed their legislatures, and we believe that today or tomorrow, South Dakota's governor is going to sign it. It's also awaiting governor's signature currently in the state of Virginia and the state of Utah. And I think that's from my memory, so that's the best I have.
First, Representative Zuros, and then we'll go back to Representative Dean.
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, members, also the definition of terminal illness, as we've been working on the bill, Senator Peterson and I, this language is agreed upon language also with other stakeholders, including MCCL. I just thought that would be important for the committee to know.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Altman, I appreciate that especially. Also, just one of the things that these drugs are probably not going to be covered by insurance because it's not on FDA, it's not a formulary. So people are in their most desperate state, obviously. Have you looked at consumer protections to protect people from unscrupulous practitioners or distributors in other states, or have you bounced that around, or what are the discussions been around that, Mr. Altman?
Mr. Altman.
Madam Chair, Representative, in fact, we have. That was a primary concern, and that's why this bill, as well as the other ones, are drafted in the fashion that they are drafted, Representative. These are not, patients cannot access drugs from, I like to say, a man in a dark coat selling a magic elixir to desperate people. These are drugs, one, there's a safety built into the legislation that says that these drugs, in order to be eligible, have to have passed phase one and remain in FDA approval testing. So they have to be somewhere in phase two and phase three of the FDA process. What that means, frankly, is that that legitimizes the drug, for lack of a better term. That means that a manufacturer has invested literally millions, if not billions of dollars into these drugs and are pushing it through the approval process with all the testing. So it's not something that I can make in my garage and sell to desperate people. It has to be within that approval process. Secondly, the patients can't do this by themselves. They can't go out and look for these drugs and access them themselves. The law requires that doctors make the recommendation. So a hypothetical of the way it would work is somebody that's in this situation is aware of the drug, more likely their doctor is aware of the drug, their treating physician that is either in use in Europe or it's showing efficacy in phase 2 or phase 3 of the FDA process, and their doctor says, hey, there's one other thing out there that might help you. We should see if we can get into a clinical trial. You can't get into a clinical trial. I would recommend this drug. You go through the other procedures. So they're protected in that fashion, that it's just not something that they can go buy on the street corner.
Representative Dean.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Altman. Thank you, Representative Zerwas. I know many Minnesota patients are struggling with FDA non-approval of things that they would like to at least try in desperate situations, and I appreciate the work and support the bill.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Altman. I'm just trying to absorb kind of how this would work in the real world for the patient. I mean, I can see if you're terminally ill and there's no hope in conventional treatments that you'd be open to trying things. And I think a lot of brave patients step forward and want to be part of at least learning whether or not it contributes to their own health. But I'm worried a little bit about the lack of patient protection here, in that it's very clear in the last section that anyone who might be on our programs, medical assistants, would not be eligible to have costs incidental to, associated with, or resulting from the use of the investigative treatment. It's not as clear a language on the private side. It just refers to costs on line 2.16, which is, I think, a significant difference. I'm not sure how the insurance industry would interpret costs, but I suspect they would interpret it as narrowly as the language on medical assistance. So that means that if I'm a terminally ill patient and I decide that I want to try this, and my physician says, you know, I've looked at some of the research, and based on what I know, you know, I don't see a problem with it. So it's administered to me, and then I go into some terrible complications. I have uncontrollable seizures. I have uncontrollable pain. I have something that one would tend to go to an emergency room or a hospital or ask for care. It appears to me that care would not be covered by insurance because it would be assumed to be associated with the experimental treatment. And you know, just having talked with a constituent who had a $6,500 bill from 4 hours in an emergency room with a pretty minor sort of thing, it feels to me like the bill needs something about patient disclosure, the financial risks in addition to the medical risks, because while it's difficult to talk finances at that point in life, most people who are terminally ill, like the young man that you mentioned who was leaving behind a pregnant wife and children, probably didn't intend to leave behind hundreds of thousands of dollars in medical debt, and I have no idea if that was what the circumstances were there. That's just an example. But I do feel like there needs to be something here in this process that does that, and maybe that you could address whether that's covered in other states or whether that's something we should think about as the bill proceeds.
Mr. Altman.
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Loeffler. That's a very valid point. It's a good point. And to answer your last question first, it is covered in some other states in the statutory language in a little more detail than this bill in some of the states. In most of the states, that is all handled through the informed consent as well. The informed consent not only talks about the medical risks, but the financial risks that go with it, and the financial responsibility in the informed consent. It's all something that the patient has to know before they do this. I can tell you, you talked about leaving medical debts. There are states out there with bills that lay out that the patient will be responsible for costs, but that cost will not go on to the patient's heirs if the patient were to die. Some of the state laws talk about the financial risk to the patients, and that it will carry on to the state or the patient's heirs if they were to pass away. So the states have approached it a little bit differently depending on the needs and circumstances and really wishes of those states. But it is addressed in the informed consent process, which some states are handling through regulatory process. Some states lay out the actual requirements of their informed consent right within their laws.
Representative Loeffler?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Roth. I hope you will pursue making that clear, because our medical finance system is so complicated that my experience is most doctors, most physicians have no idea what insurance will or won't cover. They refer you to somebody in the front office who tries to call the insurance company, and this could be, if we don't address it, it may not be handled in the way we'd like. And I'd encourage you to also look if there are other consumer protections in those other states that we should also be considering.
Representative Sirwas.
Madam Chair, members, Representative Loeffler. Yeah, no, I agree. I think there's an opportunity to further explore that. The language that you said specifically, talking about transportation to and from, that was language that DHS had asked us specifically to include. And so that's why it's in there. But I think, you know, clearly this is, there's an area there that we can explore further.
Are you finished?
Yes, okay. Thank you.
Representative Pfeiffer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a slight wording issue I caught while reading through the amendment on line 2.13. The halfway through the line, it says nothing in this section affects a professional licensing board from taking action in response to violations of any other section of law. I don't think affects is the right word there. I think probably the word you're looking for is prevents. So I don't know, you know, obviously there's no amendment submitted within the 24-hour window there, so I don't know if an oral amendment is appropriate here or not, but I just thought I'd point that out.
Representative Sirwas, or do you want to take it under advisement at this point? Or?
Yeah, and I know I will have an amendment going into public safety as well, so I'll get with House Research and make sure we have the very best word.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a few questions about this. First of all, Representative Sirwas, I didn't hear anything, I don't think, about anybody in Minnesota asking for this bill. Is somebody asking you to do this? Have you got constituents who want to do this? Because I've never been asked about this.
Great question, Representative Liebling. Last Friday, I had an op-ed piece I ran in the Star Tribune specifically about this hearing and about this bill, and I have received some emails, at least one woman that I've exchanged some information with. Unfortunately, she wasn't able to be here today for the hearing, but she's looking for some options around some treatments with ALS. And so, yes, this is an issue. This is a concern, and it's certainly something that I've faced personally. People I've been patients with have faced personally, and I don't know if it's my extended time in the hospital, but I would tell you that yes, this is an issue that impacts Minnesotans and on a deeply personal level.
Mm-hmm. Representative Liebling.
Thank you for that, Representative Sirwas. And then there was some discussion about how patients would find out about these drugs, and I want to pursue that a little bit more, because I think one of the issues that we've had here in Minnesota and probably all over the country is the advertising of drugs directly to patients. And I know that physicians sometimes find it very disconcerting, because patients who now not only see it on TV but have, of course, full access to the internet, and they come in to a doctor and they say, "Doctor, I want this drug." And that drug isn't always appropriate. Sometimes it's there's a better drug that's less expensive. And I think a lot of us believe that this drives costs. And so in this case, I'm wondering, will the companies be allowed to advertise these to patients? Or is there anything, if we authorize this with this bill, is there anything to prevent companies from advertising it? And if they don't, other than the physician saying, "I know something," how is it going to come to people's attention that there might be something, or is the physician going to be the only source of that information?
Mr. Altman.
Madam Chair, Representative, to answer the question on whether companies can do that, companies are absolutely prohibited from advertising or marketing medications that are going through the investigational new drug, or the FDA's approval application process, clinical trials. There is a federal law that prohibits that. So there's no, they are not going to be able to advertise these drugs to patients in any manner. The advertisements that you currently see are of drugs and devices, whatever it may be, that have current FDA approval and are marketable. So, yes, they're prevented from doing that. To answer how patients will find out about these, there is a significant amount. Most patients, and many that I've talked to in this situation, begin researching from day one. So there is a significant amount of research out there from the internet, through medical communities and things like that, about drugs that are going through the FDA process. In fact, the FDA's own website has a significant amount of information on that. But typically, in addition to that, where patients might come into their doctor and say, hey, I heard about this or I heard about that, typically physicians in these areas of specialty, whatever it may be, cancer is the easiest one to talk about, but it's not certainly the only one, are continuously getting journals. They have continuing medical education. There's a woman, Lorraine McCartan, who has traveled around the country with her husband with me on a couple of occasions to talk about how she found a drug like this, and it was just that. Her physician, she was diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer very late. Her physician went to a seminar in Texas. She was in Massachusetts in Texas and learned about a drug, TDM1, it was called at the time, that was in phase 2 or phase 3 of the clinical trial process, showing significant efficacy, and so that's where her doctor learned about it. So there's probably no one way that people will learn about this, but certainly through their own research and the education, the continuing education of their physicians, hopefully some of these drugs will come to light.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you kind of fed into my next question when you said that federal law prohibits this. Well, I think right now doesn't federal law prohibit what this bill is doing? And doesn't federal law preempt state law in this respect? I'm sure you get that question all the time.
Mr. Altman.
Madam Chair, Representative, I do get that question all the time. So thank you. The answer is no. In our opinion and with support of the Supreme Court, we do not believe that this kind of activity is preempted. Some federal laws preempt state law, not all of them. States have the ability, and they always do, to recognize the constitutional rights of their citizens, even to a higher degree than the federal Constitution does. They can recognize liberty interests. And that's exactly what this does. The state of Minnesota would be recognizing that people within their borders have the liberty interest to do everything they can to save their own life, their right to try. And because of that, no federal law or federal regulation can preempt that constitutional right that's been recognized by the state. Now, I'll be very, very frank with you that there would be disagreement from some people on that with me. In fact, Friday, I'm speaking at the National Academy of Sciences, where I think there's going to be significant disagreement, and that will be the subject of the debate. But at this point, I think the closest, and I'll tell you the case, there hasn't been any Supreme Court or federal precedent directly on point on this. The closest is a case from 2006 called Gonzalez versus Oregon. And that case was in a very opposite situation. It was in reference to Oregon's right to die law. The federal government challenged Oregon's ability to pass this kind of law and allow physicians to prescribe medications to end somebody's life. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, and in 2006, the Supreme Court of the United States said no. This is a liberty interest that the state of Oregon is recognizing in its citizens. Medical regulation is the traditional police power of the citizens. It's a constitutional right in Oregon that they recognize. Federal law cannot preempt that. We're not going to interfere. And that precedent would apply to this. Obviously, this is a right to try to save your life, but it's the same legal concept.
Yeah, Representative Liebling.
Thank you. And thank you very much for that. And finally, I just wonder, I say it's MMA Day here. Mm-hmm. I see a lot of probably medical students in the audience. I wonder if the MMA has a position on the bill, if they are planning to give any testimony here. I would be really interested in hearing what their viewpoint is.
Looks like we have a taker. Mr. Dick, please state your name.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Eric Dick with the Minnesota Medical Association. I could and probably should defer to one of the white coats in the audience on this, but we have talked to the author, and given the amendment that was adopted, particularly around the liability protection and the definition of terminal, we are officially neutral on the bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much.
All right. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the liability is a question I have. Representative Loeffler mentioned the cost to the individual, but I'm also concerned about taxpayer costs. And if something happened, like she mentioned, often we're going to end up paying our taxpayer care for that person, both emergency room, probably after, in different ways. And so how do we, is there any way, I don't see anything in here that would protect the taxpayer from having to pay all of those bad things that could happen if this happens. It seems like there's no way in here to, that you've got to help protect the taxpayer in any way. Am I wrong?
Mr. Altman?
You can start and I'll finish.
Madam Chair, Representative, I guess I'll start with first, there, when these laws initially go into effect, there won't be a significant amount of people taking advantage of them. So that's one relief. But yeah, I've had this question, and we've done some analysis on the tax question and any sort of burden to the public of these laws. And what we've really come down to is that there is no additional burden to the public at all. And I say that because folks in this situation, because costs are generally not going to be covered, we don't prohibit insurance companies from covering this cost, but they probably won't. In fact, probably 100% they won't. So the costs are going to be borne by the patient at that point. So it's going to be a patient in a situation that has figured out a way to take care of those costs. And I digress a little bit, but there are a number of nonprofits and things that are starting around the country to help patients pay. But as far as the taxpayer liability, it's not going to increase that burden in any event, because folks in this condition that are terminal are going to require those services with or without these investigational new drugs. Hopefully these investigational new drugs would maybe lessen any taxpayer burden, because these people may benefit from it. But if they do not elect to receive drug, or they don't receive a drug under a right to try law, their hospital visits are going to take place anyway. Their emergency rooms visits are going to take place anyway, because they are in a condition where their terminal and end-of-life care is going to be necessary. So the burden, I guess what I'm trying to tell you, is the burden on the taxpayer is not going to increase at all because of these. In fact, it won't affect it. It shouldn't affect it at all.
Representative Zerwas?
Madam Chair, and Representative Mullery, and that's specifically why we have the request, the language that DHS requested in there, to make that clear, that kind of the ancillary services around experimental treatment wouldn't also be expected to be covered. And then why we're continuing to work, and we'll have another amendment from the Department of Corrections around exempting them from these provisions as well. And so certainly we're not trying to transfer a cost or burden onto the state. Anybody, any patient or patient's family that's going to go through this process in collaboration with their care team will have determined, you know, what that looks like, what their plan is for treatment, and the ancillary services provided around that. They will have entered into the waiver and the agreement. And so I understand that complications can arise, but no one will be in this program that hasn't gone into it knowing kind of where they're at and what the cost implications are.
Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, I listened to both of you, and I'm not at all satisfied. not even slightly. What you said, and I can't remember, your name, but Altman, it does happen. There could be a lot of triggers to emergency to other services that are far in addition to what we would have to put into a person who's dying. Often a person who's dying in these circumstances actually don't cost that much to the state, whereas this could trigger a whole bunch of extreme costs. So I don't see anything in here, and if you're, I would hope that you work on something on that, and I don't know if there is any way to get something on it as you proceed to the next committee.
Madam Chair, members, I'll just tell you, we're an HHS policy, and I'm a little uncomfortable with the idea for a policy discussion, Representative Mullery, to say that it costs less when people just go home and die. I'm not comfortable with that statement, and I don't want to dwell on it. But I'll say, Madam Chair, members, we're here to talk about a policy. I understand there's a cost implication to that. Madam Chair, members, I have a different perspective on this. You know, I was 15 years old, and I picked out who was going to be my pallbearers and who was going to read at my funeral. And the doctor said, no, there's one last thing we can try. It's experimental. It's a procedure. We don't think your insurance company's going to cover it. But we want you to try it at the very least with this heart surgery by reconstructing your heart. Even if it doesn't work, dying as a 15-year-old kid, we're going to learn so much from trying this. Members, that's what this bill is about. And I'm sorry, I have a very difficult time with the idea that it's cheaper to send someone home to die.
Last question from Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was visiting with Representative Nick about this yesterday, actually, a little bit. And one of the questions I had was to Mr. Altman, I think, again, even in Nick's case, sorry, Representative Zerwas, a child, a minor, does the parent have the ability to make that decision then for a situation like this? That would be my first question, and my second and final. How about an adult that's in a kind of a confused state? How do you deal with that kind of an issue if that isn't real clear, and what kind of a state do they have to be in? So, thank you.
And my apologies, we do have a question from Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I need two clarifications because if I have some constituents and one particularly that would really be interested in 1.15, the legal definition of soon. There's one other clarification on the next page, but I appreciate the change because I know many constituents that have MS that the original definition, they were terminal or have been terminal for years, but I'd like to understand the soon part of that.
Yep.
Representative West.
Madam Chair, members, Representative Quam, that addition of that word soon, it mirrors the Virginia language, and it was a compromise with MCCL. And the example that in discussions with them, one of their discussions was diabetes, if not treated, could be considered terminal, and some other conditions. So I think there was some consternation around that. It's something that we're continuing to flesh out. And I think it depends on a lot of things. Is a few years, is that soon if we're talking about a child or how that looks? So that's something that discussions around that continue, and I'd be open to working with you as we move through the process. And I don't know if that's defined in other states.
Mr. Altman?
Madam Chair, Representative, other states, many of the definitions are based on other definitions of terminal illnesses in their respective codes. Some of the states, I can tell you, I can't give you the numbers, but some say exactly like you see here, soon. Some say imminent. Some don't have a time frame at all. Just, for instance, they would delete the word soon, and procedures, life-sustaining, without life-sustaining procedures will result in death. So that the way they've been defined, that is based on some FDA language as well, but the way they've been defined with that soon or imminent or the lack thereof has been primarily dependent on other parts of each state's code to be consistent within their code. The legal definition of soon is really a case-by-case basis, to be quite frank, Representative. What is soon? If it's ever challenged on what soon is, courts look at that based on the totality of the circumstances in that situation to make that determination. One of the reasons a specific 6 months or 1 year or some sort of time frame like that was not recommended and really is not in any of the state laws around the country is because time is not on the side of these folks, and maybe 6 months isn't long enough for this to work. Maybe a year isn't long enough to work, and we wanted to make sure that it was open to enough, like ALS. If you have ALS, you are likely going to die from ALS, but it's not going to necessarily be within a year. So, but once you get within that year, it may be too late to have any success with the investigational treatments. So the definition, as written here, as Representative Zerwas says, is identical to at least a couple states that are out there and have this bill running or law currently.
Ms. Representative Quam?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And also, I would hope that if it was possible to have some language, because some of the protocols and treatments, there are several weeks that you would go through because you're build up, and maybe you go on to a secondary drug, and that there would, you know, soon would have to be long enough to actually allow for that treatment. But the other point for clarification is, I have a specific constituent with MS who is a federal employee, like probably tens of thousands in our state, who doesn't have, you know, they have Blue Cross Blue Shield Federal, which doesn't seem to fit into when we tried to cover state, local government, and et cetera. And I'm not sure if you, for completeness, you need to look at that too.
Representative
Zero. Madam Chair, members, I mean, I think that would be, you would have private, it would be in a private insurance contract, and they wouldn't be compelled to cover that.
Okay, and I failed to let you answer Representative Baker's question. Do you want to ask that one more time really quick?
Thank you. Actually, Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Mason. She pointed out it was actually listed in the very bottom of that bill, so I got my question answered. Thank you so much.
Perfect. Thank you. All right. I think if there's no further questions, Representative Zerwas renews his motion that House File 236, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Crime Prevention Policy and Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say no. The motion prevails. And you are on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for being here. We know you have a flight to catch.
Thank you very much.
Our next bill is House File 877, Representative Anderson. Welcome, Representative Anderson.
Thank you.
So I will move the House File 877 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. And we have the bill before us. I'm not aware of any amendments, so Representative Anderson, to your bill.
Thanks, Madam Chair. This bill is rather straightforward. It provides a supplemental increase service rate for a group residential housing provider in Stearns County that works with veterans up in Stearns County. It was last year that through a lot of work, working with Stearns County, we were able to get the GRH Level 1 funding, and now they are providing additional services to the veterans there, doing a great job, I might add, and would like to seek this additional, I believe it's called Level 2 funding. And the director was going to come down today and visit for a minute, but they were doing a suicide prevention program there, so she couldn't make it, and that's the reason we didn't have names for our testifiers, so I apologize for that, but a couple fellows did come down to visit with us, and I have a familiar face to kind of walk through what this GRH level would be, and I'd like to introduce him right now, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Jim Abler, representing the Eagles Healing Nest on a pro bono basis. It's nice I can be here in this context for my first human service appearance. Eagles Healing Nest is a place in Sauk Center, and the committee from last year will be familiar with it. I believe they have 65 beds now. They pretty much fill in gaps in the VA system and find people who have fallen, who would otherwise be at high risk for suicide and just homelessness and great challenge. I know that the committee is running long on testimony, so we can be very brief. But if you have a chance to get there, you'll be impressed with what the private side can do through donations and a one-woman, Melanie Butler's commitment to the wellness of veterans. And so this bill, last year we were able to work with Stearns County to get basic level of group residential housing, which is $800 and some a month. This bill requests the enhanced rate of $1,400 and something, which will allow them to spend a little bit more money on programming and services. They've come a long ways with their work. They currently raise about $20,000 in private money every month to house the 60 or so veterans who are there. And this is going to have to finance, and then there'll be a matter of decisions and choices by that committee how they're going to handle it. But I wanted to bring this forward, and maybe with a minute or so each person could just say hello, and then we can take questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much.
Hello. My name is Bruce Sabota, and I'd like to thank you for having me here. I met Melanie 2.5 years ago up at the Eagles Healing Nest, and she just started out up there. And it's to what she's done and to what she's done for us vets, it's amazing. She's took old buildings. People have come in and donated their time and energy, reconverted them, got the paint on the walls and carpet on the floors. And I mean, it's amazing. And now they're up to, they started out with one building with 30 vets, and another one that got them up to 47. It's opened a third building about 6 weeks ago, and they're up to 64 now. It's all private funded, and the vets work out. The vets cook their own meals. They clean their rooms. They clean the, they do everything up there. It's different. It's not institutionalized. The program she's getting in there for us vets is, it's great. And it's an open invitation to any if you're up in the Sauk Center area. That door is always open for you to take a tour. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, my name is Mike Spouty. I volunteer up at Eagles Healing Nest. I'm not a veteran. I feel I owe these guys something, our veterans. But I've been volunteering up there for about a year, and it's my understanding with the bill that it will increase their GRH funding, which will help them provide a full-time paid nurse on staff, which they don't have at this point. The gentleman that's doing it at this point is seeking a paying job. He's volunteer right now. So what they're looking to do with some of this money is to provide a full-time nurse on staff.
Thank you very much. Are there any other testifiers from the audience that would like to speak on this bill? All right. Do we have any member questions? Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not a question, but a comment. I first heard about this at the state celebration on Veterans Day last year, and I've heard numerous positive comments about that, so I definitely would like to support it.
Thank you. Well, with no further questions, I will renew my motion that House File 877 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Representative Anderson, would you like anything else to add before we vote?
No, thank you very much, Madam Chair. Just this is the old girls' reform school up in Sauk Center. It's a beautiful campus, and the buildings have been empty for a number of years. And as I mentioned, they now are working on their fourth building, rehabilitating it, and a lot of volunteer work. So it's just a great program, and I appreciate the kind words because the program is working, veterans helping veterans. Thank you.
Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say no. Motion prevails.
Thank you
very
Madam
much.
Chair.
Thank you.
Our next House file is 439. We have Representative Lohmer.
Good
Hi, Representative Lohmer. Would you like to start by moving your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move House File 439 and have it re-referred to Health and Human Services Finance, please.
And I'm not aware of any amendments, so to your bill.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House File 439 is called the Prenatal Trisomy Diagnosis Awareness Act. And it is a bill that was brought to my attention by a mom named Heather, who's here today. And you're being passed out a letter and some pictures. And the picture is of Heather's beautiful daughters. So she's a mom from Stillwater. And her youngest daughter, Isabel, was born with Down syndrome. So Izzy's mom, Heather, has become very involved in the Down Syndrome Diagnosis Network and asked me to sponsor a bill similar to one that has been passed in 7 states to date: Massachusetts in 2012, Kentucky in 2013, Pennsylvania, Louisiana, Delaware, Ohio, and Maryland in 2014. So this bill simply states that when a prenatal diagnosis is made of one of the 3 trisomies, 13, 18, and 21, the healthcare practitioner who orders the test for a pregnant woman for screening purposes shall provide full and complete and up-to-date information about the trisomy conditions to the mother. The information that should be given to the mother is on page 2 of the bill, if you're interested. And the Department of Health has quality, up-to-date information on their website. So the physician simply needs to point the pregnant woman, mm-hmm. pregnant mother, to the website where she will find all the information that's required. So we have been in communication with the department and have not heard of any opposition to this bill. And there's no cost to the bill since the department already has the information on their website. And I just want to mention what the bill does not do. It does not take away a woman's choice or decision-making ability regarding the pregnancy at all. It does not preclude the doctor, the physician, from giving any medical advice to the patient at all. So this bill will really help families navigate through this challenging time and through this diagnosis. This bill will also help to increase awareness for the 3 trisomies among the general public. It also creates opportunities for more research and advocacy by educating families and people on how to care for children with trisomy. So I have several testifiers here with me today who'd like to speak in favor of this bill.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the records and proceed.
I am Sandy Holmgren, and thank you, Madam Chair and committee. And here's our story. My husband, Craig, and I went through 6 years of infertility, and when we were told we were never having children, and it was a miracle that we became pregnant. At that point, the doctors wanted to do testing early in the pregnancy. I opted out because of the risks involved. At 28 weeks gestation, I started having contractions. At 31 weeks, I was admitted to the hospital with a condition called polyhydramnios, which means that I have excessive amnio fluid. They removed 5.5 liters of amnio from me and proceeded to do testing at that point. 7 days into my 15-day stay in the hospital, my doctors and various nurses and staff entered my room, and it felt like a morgue. They had called my husband and told him the results of the test, and he was on his way to the hospital. As my doctor walked into the room, he said, "I am so sorry." I was confused and did not know what he was talking about. When I asked him, he proceeded to tell me that my baby had Down syndrome. I was by myself taking in all this information, and I fell apart. Minutes later, my husband did show up, but they didn't even wait for him to be in the room before they told me that what the outcome was going to be. During the next week, we were given lots of material on what to expect, what could happen, and who to contact. Much of the material was outdated. I was completely overwhelmed with this information and at some point quit reading because I couldn't handle all the information. At 33.5 weeks by emergency C-section, my daughter Michaela was born. She did not have an esophagus and had a blocked bowel and was taken away immediately for surgery. Through the advances of medical technology, her life was saved. Because she was a preemie, we were told that she may never take a bottle and may have to be on feeding tubes for a very long time. She was nursing before she left the NICU. We were told she probably would not walk until she was 3 or 4 years old. She walked at 13 months. We were told she may not start talking until at least 2 years old. Her first word was banana at 9 months old.
Wow.
And she hasn't stopped talking since. We were told all of the negative things that could happen, but we were never told of the positive things that will happen. Michaela has been such a blessing to our family. Her smile, her laughter, her joy, and the little things. She has been a fighter and an achiever. Today, she is a very accomplished 20-year-old. She has excelled academically. She has won awards for dances that she has choreographed herself. She has been admitted to Bethel University in their new field program. And just like you and me, she has dreams for the future, dreams of being a teacher, of living independently, and of traveling the world. Young parents need to hear the upside of what their child can accomplish someday. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. Michaela, would you like to add anything?
I thought there was going
to be... Oh, sorry.
Come on. I can hear you.
My name is Kayla Holmgren. I am 20 years old. I attended St. Clair Preparatory Academy, and I am currently in other professions program. I am a teacher assistant in law school, and I love painting. My passion is dancing, and I choreograph my own dances. I have won some awards for it. I have been accepted to Bethel University Field Program. I want to be a teacher someday. Thank you all very much.
Thank you. You're beautiful, just like your mom. Mm-hmm. All right. And
hello, I'm Mindy Smilgas. I don't have anything written down prepared. Thank you for having me. I am the mother to a wonderful 8.5-year-old son who has Down syndrome. I did receive a prenatal diagnosis. I had refused all the other tests with my three older children, but there was some issues. They kind of strongly suggested that I have an amnio done at 20 weeks. I waited the full 2 weeks to get the results back. At the time I was 31, I wasn't in a high-risk group, and they really didn't think he had Down syndrome, but I was given the information over the telephone, and I'll never forget the day. It was April 11th. It'll be 9 years this April, and my world stopped, and I didn't have anyone there with me, and it was a very scary time. And I actually on my own researched out some things on the internet and found the Minnesota Down Syndrome Society and called them and got information. But I did go in for an appointment later and was given information where I could go to have an abortion at up till 24 weeks. I actually told the genetic counselor that there was waiting lists in every state for people who are looking to adopt specifically Down syndrome children or babies, and she did not know. She should have been giving me that information, but so I was telling her that, and she, you know, was let me know where I could go to terminate, and it was 23 weeks, so she said I better hurry. From the time I was received the diagnosis, everything within the medical community was negative. They were looking for problems right away. They told me he had a brain tumor that was inoperable and that he was going to need heart surgery right after birth, and neither of those things were true. Because of my personal faith, I chose to keep my son and not abort, but that was my beliefs before. I still struggle feeling like I was doing the wrong thing keeping him. I never received any positive information or any materials until I reached out to the Down Syndrome Association of Minnesota, which was a saving grace for me, and I still have a strong relationship with the president who I spoke to, Kathleen Forney, who told me about her son, who was 27 at the time, and that he lived independently and worked, and it just gave me hope for his future. And my son arrived healthy 7 pounds, 12 ounces, left the hospital with us, nursed immediately, and they're supposed to have all these problems, and it's just, they can, but they don't all have these problems. And I reached out and made some connections on my own, but it would sure be nice to have been given some current materials, because even looking at books, things are so outdated. And now there's just wonderful networks with other parents to connect and just reach out and get some questions answered from people who actually live this and have the children with Down syndrome.
Thank you. And yes, hello.
Hi, thank you so much for hearing this. This is an important topic to me. I'm the founder of the Down Syndrome Diagnosis Network. We're an organization that supports new and expectant parents. And the story that
Can
she
you
just...
state
just,
your name for the record?
Oh, Heather Bradley, sorry. And the statement she just said is something that we hear all the time from families, both in Minnesota and across the country, where they just aren't receiving any resources. And almost equally as important as receiving some sort of information about what Down syndrome is, what a certain genetic condition is getting access to the support networks that are already in place. And so that's why our organization, which is a very pro-information organization, supports this bill. It simply allows families to understand what diagnosis they're dealing with, what the current information is about it, and it also gives them access to the numerous organizations and support networks that are already out there. And so I just so thankful to see that this is hopefully going to be passed.
Thank you very much. Are there any other testifiers on this bill? Okay. Representative Liebling, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you very much, Madam Chair. And thank you all. This is, I really didn't know anything about this, and it's certainly, your stories are really compelling, and certainly this is something of great interest to all of us. I have some just questions about how the bill works, though. I mean, first of all, you know, we have the letter from the Minnesota Medical Association, and one of the sort of issues that's been around for a while is mandating health practitioners to give certain information. And I totally understand why you all think this is important, believe me. And I think the idea of having it on the website of the Department of Health is a great idea, to have one place where there's an authoritative, up-to-date resource that people can all point to, I think is wonderful. But I'm a little bit concerned when we say that a practitioner shall provide information. And part of the reason I'm concerned about that is that even in some of the stories that you all told, the practitioner may believe that they're giving the right information, and still it may not be the right information. I think that's helped by having a place to point to. But information does change. And sometimes, even some of the stories that you all told, I was kind of sitting here wondering how the bill would have helped that, because you can't legislate somebody's bedside manner, unfortunately, and there isn't any real even enforcement mechanism in the bill that I'm aware of. So that's kind of my first concern. You know, what if a practitioner doesn't give the information or gives wrong information? Or, I mean, I think we could pretty much say that healthcare providers want to give their patients information and want to be helpful to their patients, but, you know, busy practices being what they are and people being humans, it doesn't always go the way it should. And of course, for the parents for whom this is like a pivotal moment in your life that you're never going to forget, you know, we all have those, you're going to remember forever what that doctor said to you. But for that doctor, you may be one of 10 patients that week, you know, who had different things. So just let me kind of put that out there, that it's a little bit concerning to me that we're mandating that a provider has to say a certain thing. Now, before you respond to that, let me just tell you a couple other things that I've noticed about the bill that I just have questions about. One is on line 2.3, where it says up-to-date and evidence-based information, which is great, that has been reviewed by medical experts and national trisomy organizations. And that it might be that everybody agrees on the same information, but I'm kind of wondering what happens if there's a disagreement, if there's some kind of development in the field and people disagree, there's some developing science around something, who gets the final word? I guess that's my question on that. And then I'm kind of giving you a lot at once, but you can do them one after the other. And then finally, on line 2.17, where it talks about ensuring, says the commissioner shall ensure the information be culturally and linguistically appropriate for all recipients. That's a great goal, you know? I mean, gosh, we want everybody to be able to access the information and understand it, but I don't know, isn't it a little unrealistic to say the commissioner shall do it for all recipients? Even in my school district, there are 85 different languages spoken. So I think that's kind of a huge task to mandate in statute for one of our agencies, and I wonder if you have a comment, response to that, Representative Lohmer, one of your testifiers.
No, I was just going to respond to your first question and just mentioning that, medical providers be mandated on what to say, and the bill, in fact, does not mandate them what to say. They can still say, I'm really sorry, your child likely has Down syndrome. They could say, I really think you should terminate the pregnancy. They could say, your child is going to be a burden. But what we want them to give and what they need to be, what patients need to be given, is outcomes for what their children's condition is. And that, I think, we can all agree is necessary. They can have an opinion that this particular condition is burdensome. They can have an opinion and share it with their patient that they don't think that's the best decision. We're not asking them to change their mind. We're simply saying, give the patient information about the condition so they can make an informed choice about their pregnancy. At the end of the day, I think that's pretty basic, and I think doctors are already doing that in any other condition that they're advising their patient on.
And could I, Madam Chair?
Representative Lee.
Thank you. And thank you for that. And I just want to say that, gosh, I hope that physicians aren't imposing their value judgments on patients. I mean, let's just say up front that, you know, people, I think women and families are very capable of making their own decisions about these issues on both sides. And I really, you know, and of course we can't, and you're not trying to mandate, because we can't stop people from saying what they want to say. But, you know, let's just say I'm certainly not defending that at all. I just want to make that real clear.
Ms. Smiglis.
Hi. I personally experienced there is a big push to abort. And I personally had the genetic counselor tell me that she became a mother later in life, and she personally chose to have amnios with all three of her children because she would never deal with it. And once I said to her, that's nice, but I'm, and this was before the test. And when we went back to her, I already knew her feelings, and she was telling me, you know, to get a flight, you know, that if it was her, basically she would be flying. I had a week to get to St. Louis because they would allow an abortion up to 24 weeks with a Down syndrome child. And I honestly felt pressure. And I already went into this with a strong pro-life feeling before I knew my son had Down syndrome. I've been pro-life. So I can't imagine someone else who was wavering and maybe wasn't necessarily pro-life and had somebody tell them that in a you know, a doctor or a genetic counselor, whatever degree she would hold. So it does happen. And it, the whole time I went through my pregnancy, I was seen by specialists at a perinatologist. And I was told stories about how nurses would go out and cry when our babies were born. And I even asked my own family, can I send out birth announcements? I mean, it was just the whole time that I was pregnant, it seemed like I was doing the wrong thing by keeping him. So that stigma is still out there because the information is not given about the wonderful things that our kids can do. Michaela is a wonderful dancer. I mean, I teared up over this. The things that our kids are capable of are amazing, and they're not. Those outcomes are pretty outdated in some information. But I think that the website that is being referred to here is would be having the most up-to-date information available.
And getting back to your question about identifying the resource, in the other states where this bill is passed, specifically in regard to Down syndrome, the Department of Public Health in there have identified resources that fit those criteria. Major Down syndrome organizations across the country have these resources available for free. Physicians can download them off of websites. And so that will be up to the Department of Health to determine what fits that criteria of the bill, but there are resources that do currently fit the criteria of the bill.
Thank you.
And then, Madam Chair.
Okay, certainly. Representative Liebling, and then we'll go to the representative.
Thank you. Sorry, there was a third part to that, and that was about the all recipients, the culturally appropriate for all recipients piece.
Ms. Bradley?
Yeah, I mean, I think that obviously that's a high standard to ask. You know, when we talk about Down syndrome, and specifically, we've got in our population a life expectancy currently about to 65, but when you look at the Hispanic and the African American population, the life expectancy is closer to 25. And especially when you're talking about Hispanic, a lot of that has to do with the lack of resources and the lack of understanding that there are services available for our children, the lack of understanding that the medical care exists. And so I really think the need to have this information in a way that is understandable for all parents is so important, because it does impact life outcomes in so many of these children.
Thank you. Representative Mason?
I have one question, and first, and I do have an uncle who is Down syndrome, so I'm aware of what it's like to have a family member like that. But the way I'm interpreting this bill is that you're actually, I'm interpreting it as a way of questioning the ability of our physicians and trying to tell them what to do. And I guess I have a real. If you have problems with the physician you're going to, why wouldn't you go to another one?
I would say that a lot of families really know nothing about genetic conditions. Our hope would be that this conversation is happening before women are even getting prenatal testing, that they're learning about the genetic conditions that they're getting tested for. However, research shows that that's not happening. In fact, doctors, only about 30% of them feel that they're prepared to deliver a diagnosis of Down syndrome. There's been studies that show that they just don't feel they're prepared. And if you think about it, it really makes sense. OBs, well, in the case of Down syndrome, there's only 1 in 800 babies that are actually born with Down syndrome. If you're an OB in a clinic and you have to deliver the news that a baby has Down syndrome, how motivated will you be to really get educated on what that condition is when you're only seeing it in your practice 1 out of 800 births? You could go your entire practice without having a baby born with these conditions. So how inclined are you to understand what those conditions are really looking like today? It could be completely different from when the physician was in medical school, when in 1980 there was a life expectancy of 20, versus today when the life expectancy is 65, when back in 1980 children were getting institutionalized and today they're going to college. So there's a huge disconnect there, and not a lot of motivations for physicians to get educated on the changes in the diagnoses. That's why great people like the Minnesota Down Syndrome Associations are constantly doing medical outreach and speaking to universities and educating physicians on what the condition really looks like now. But unfortunately, you just hear so many times that families don't get that up-to-date information. So I think that in a lot of other instances, we mandate physicians to give out certain types of information. I don't think that's unheard of. And in this case, it's definitely necessary.
Okay, and I don't see any other further questions. Oh, Representative Palmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to address back to Representative Leek's question. And the language, the department was fine with the language when it comes to, you know, the differences with cultural and linguistic. And this was actually recommended. So I wanted to give you some comfort on that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Well, I don't see any further questions. It sounded like a nice little wrap-up on your report. So Representative Lohmer renews her motion that House File 439 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say no. Motion prevails, and you're on your way to your next committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members.
And then members and others, we will be recessing at, and we will be coming back promptly around 6:15 in this room, in the basement. All right, and then for now, I guess, do I gavel to that? Yeah, so we're recessed. Thank you.
Okay, members, we're going to continue with our agenda from earlier today, and our next bill up is going to be House File 1088, Representative O'Neill's bill. And so, Representative O'Neill, while you're coming forward, I will move that House File 1088 be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Crime Prevention, Policy, and Finance. And we have the bill in front of us, and Representative O'Neill, I'm not aware of any amendments. That's correct. And so, with that, welcome to the committee. And Representative O'Neill, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Today, I am so honored to have with me two amazing women from my district. I have President Jennifer Meisner from the Buffalo Hospital and Mary Ellen Wells, the administrator from the Monticello Hospital. And today, we want to talk about a really important bill for the hospitals, the staff, and the patients. We were back in my district, and we were sharing some of our concerns about violence in the workplace. So when we started to talk, we're trying to come up with different solutions. And some of the solutions that we came up with are in this bill. There are other solutions, but this is one of the solutions that we were looking at. As we were talking about different solutions, we also talked about the deep desire that we don't want to punish those that are coming into the hospital or the emergency room in the middle of a mental health crisis. And so we want to make absolutely sure that we're not adding additional court and legal and criminal charges to someone that's seeking help. And so that is not what this bill does. This bill does, however, basically take the hospital, the nursing home or the hospice facility, and place them into the safe zone like you would for a school. And so it's modeled after school safe zones. And there's also a component about if someone is coming in and being brought there by the criminal justice system, that if they do lash out and strike a staff person, that they would be serving not concurrent concurrent sentences, but actually consecutive. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers who have come a long way and stayed a long time to be able to testify. And I'm very, very proud and happy to have them here today.
Welcome to the committee, and thank you so much for your patience with the hearing being this evening. We really appreciate it. So if you could just introduce yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony. And we're keeping it to a few minutes per testifier.
Page and a half, not even that. Double-spaced. Big.
No problem.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you so much for having us. My name is Mary Ellen Wells, and I am the administrator at CenterCare Health Monticello. It's a facility that has 35 hospital beds, a busy ER, and an 89-bed nursing facility. So we have several venues where issues such as what we're talking here tonight can occur. And my colleague here with me, Jennifer Meister, is also going to testify and provide some good examples for you as we describe to you the necessity for this bill. I'll tell you, I come to work every day, and I ask the staff who come to work every day to concentrate on providing the best care possible. We want them to provide all of their energy toward that care. When it has happened, though, that when they come to work, they may have to be concerned about their own safety, and that prevents the best care from being provided. We're hoping that House File 1088 to be an important part of the puzzle that we are constructing to take care of issues of violence in the workplace. Many steps are being taken. This is one. And Jennifer's going to talk about some of those steps. We think this bill will go a long way in conjunction with those other steps to create a culture of safety for our staff and for our patients and residents. So this, as Representative O'Neill mentioned, this bill is to treat hospitals and healthcare facilities like a school, so that when any kind of violent crime occurs, the potential for a stiffer sentence is available for those people. We wish all of society were less prone to violence, but we have to recognize that healthcare facilities are even more susceptible, and our employees are even in more vulnerable than in normal societal situations. So I hope that you'll take this under advisement and that you'll continue to help us with our efforts to prevent violence, and when it does occur, that we can respond quickly and appropriately and help everyone involved. So I'm going to turn now to Jennifer and have her provide some specifics.
Great, thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Meister. I'm the president of Buffalo Hospital in Buffalo, Minnesota. We're a regional hospital that provides care to about 70,000 people a year. I really thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 1088. I also want to thank Representative O'Neill. She's been a great advocate for the patients and staff in our communities, and I think it's important that she's a part of this bill because it's really important to all of us. I'm sad to say that we've seen an increase in the number and the severity of safety incidents at Buffalo Hospital and in healthcare facilities across the state. I believe we can all agree that there's no place for violence in a healing environment. At Buffalo Hospital, we've made a commitment to our staff and our patients to reduce the risk of violence. Mary Ellen and other hospital leaders are taking similar measures to these, and I'll go through some of the measures that we've taken over the last 4 years to reduce violence. We doubled our number of security guards. We've invested in conflict de-escalation training for our staff. We train and we retrain our staff on ways to reduce violence and protect themselves. We've modified our facility to include safe rooms and a seclusion room. We've installed security buttons at every desk for them to call a code green, which is a response to a patient that's gotten out of control. Our staff report every event, and we investigate them to see how we can better protect our staff and our patients. So every single one is reported and investigated. All the measures we have taken have required an enormous amount of time and resources, and I estimate that we've probably spent in the last 4 years about $2 million in training and facility modifications on behalf of protecting our staff and our patients from violence. It's a significant resource commitment, but it's absolutely the right thing to do. Now I'm going to tell you two stories of the verbal and physical violence against our staff, and these are just two of many unfortunate stories against staff. A patient in our emergency department came in saying he needed to be seen and that he was going crazy. He came up to our registration specialist, told her she needed to write down what he was going to say. And then he proceeded to say with a sense of calm in his voice, "I'm going to kill you, and I'm going to take your bones. I'm going to kill all of you." And our security guard responded quickly to restrain him and called the police. But the verbal impact of that goes on forever. An example of physical violence occurred to one of our nurses who was caring for an older patient in the ICU. Our nurse had just returned to work following a hernia repair surgery 3 months earlier. The patient, who had appeared calm for the most part during the visit, had a history of violence that was unknown to our staff, hadn't been disclosed by the family. The patient struck our nurse directly in her abdomen at the site of her earlier surgery, causing her significant pain. So these are just a few of many examples I could share with you about the physical and the verbal assaults on our staff. We work every day to create a culture of safety at Buffalo Hospital and Monticello Hospital and all the hospitals across the state. We involve our unions, our staff, our physicians, and community partners. House File 1088 is an important step in the right direction to create community expectations that hospitals are for healing and to let our staff know that we really care. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. And just a question for you, Ms. Meister. Did you say, and I'm just clarifying, $2 million spent, is that just Buffalo Hospital that has spent that on security measures and preparing your staff?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Members, any questions for the author or the testifiers? Representative Schultz.
So what can be done? I mean, what's leading to this? What can be done in terms of not just security but preventing this? Are we putting, are there patients in hospitals there too long that have mental health conditions and they're too severe for the hospital setting? So do you have any insight on that?
Ms. Meister?
Sure. I think we have a lack. It's about 50% of the cases of violence are with patients who have a known mental health condition, so they're not all coming in with mental health conditions. Some are exacerbated by their medical conditions or medication that can also do that. But I think there's an underlying problem is lack of facilities for mental health patients with mental health conditions. We really just don't have adequate facilities or resources in the state for that. We've seen a really a rise in that.
And Ms. Wells?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I want to also say that this isn't strictly about the mental health issues. Certainly there is a mental health crisis, really, in the provision of services across the state. But this is also, when you look, about half of the violent incidents that are occurring are not behavioral health related. They are acts of maybe there's a family dispute, domestic dispute situation, anger, whatever the case may be, it may not be mental health related.
Representative Schultz?
Thank you. Do you have data on that? Do you collect information on that you could share with the committee?
Ms. Wells?
I don't have that with me, but I certainly can provide you information.
That'd be great.
We also, I think it's across the state, hospitals are asking their staff to report. So we do have occurrence reports on violent actions that are occurring, and we do track that. I believe last year we had 67, but I don't want to be quoted on that. I will get that correct number to you.
Great. Thank you. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My first question, and I can't remember, I was here when we added these enhancements, but is this the exact same way that we do the enhancements consecutive instead of concurrent and also raising them by these amounts for the other ones that are listed, the schools and the parks? Is this the exact same way that we did the others?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Miller. We actually have another testifier that can speak to those specific things that has the historical information. So
welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and respond to the question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Matt Anderson. I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. We are strong supporters of House File 1088. The way that the language is currently drafted is it inserts the new definition of patient care zone in the same statutes that apply to school zones, park zones, public housing zones, chemical treatment zones. So it does use the same exact mechanism as those zones. The one exception is for people who are in jail who come to the hospital to get hospital-level care during their sentence. Currently, under current law, if they commit an assault while they're in jail, that sentence runs consecutive to their existing sentence. And what this bill would do is allow that while they're in the hospital, if they commit an assault, it would be just like committing an assault while they're in jail. The mere fact that they're getting care in the hospital shouldn't change the consequences of their crime if they become violent.
Okay.
Representative Mullery?
I guess just a comment. Right now, I understand we want to stop that, but I was also involved with the enhancements on the other ones, and it was to discourage activity. But in this case, everything I've heard was basically it wouldn't discourage it because it was either mental or mental illness or in the heat of passion. You're not going to discourage somebody in either of those situations. So it's not like the other enhancements because I was around for when we did those. So it's quite a bit different. We're now going after somebody for a mental state they're in, and this isn't going to have any kind of a negative effect on what happened. So I'm concerned that we're going into a new area. We've never been on these enhancements. And I don't really have a question or an answer for that, but it is a big concern.
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, that certainly is a legitimate concern, and one shared by the hospitals is how do you create deterrence for aggressive and violent behavior? We've worked cooperatively with a broad stakeholder coalition along with the Minnesota Department of Health to create roadmaps and protocols for best practices around prevention and de-escalation and staff training. We're trying to do as much of that as we can. What this bill does is, particularly as you noted, that some of the offenses are heat of the moment, things that are unlikely to be deterred, quite honestly, by any criminal law because people are not thinking that way at the time that they act. It also applies, however, to illegal drug possession and drug sales, which right now hospitals will tell you there are people waiting outside the emergency room as people come out saying, listen, did you get a prescription? Can I buy it from you? So it would impact those kind of sales, which I would argue are not necessarily heat of the moment kind of events. It would also address terroristic threats and bomb threats. Again, not necessarily heat of the moment, but if you think of a bomb threat being called into a hospital to evacuate a hospital or a nursing home, that's life-threatening for those patients. Just the mere fact of evacuation, whether there's a bomb or not, it can be life-threatening, and so for those kind of instances as well. And quite honestly, some of the violent acts are acts where someone is, in a gang-related case or something like that, where someone is coming into the hospital looking for someone. One of the advantages of this law would be allowing hospitals, nursing homes, and hospices to also post that they are patient care zones, safe zones, and to be able to begin to have, over perhaps a long period of time, but begin to address some of the cultural changes to reinstill for people the notion that when you come to a hospital, a hospice, a nursing home, long-term care facility, that this is a place of safety and healing, and the expectations are different.
Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, two of those points I totally agree with because I know of the situations. North Memorial is two blocks from my district, and so I'm in there visiting people, and I know that there's gang members in there, and the other gang will be trying to get in and find out where the gang member that didn't die when they shot him is so they can finish him off. So I totally understand that. And about the nursing home and drugs, I don't know if anybody knows, but a nursing home in my district got shut down a few months ago because there was drugs being sold regularly right to the patients in the nursing home. And looked like either the leadership was involved or overlooking it. One of the points made, though, about how horrible it was that somebody said, I'll kill you all, or what, like that. That sounded like a real, probably an emotional thing from worked up about being something happening there. I hope as you go along, you'll get maybe some further into this so that we get at the other things that are not mental and emotional outbursts and get at the other things so that we can kind of exclude the mental problems from the real intentional type of thing like that you're getting at when you came back.
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and Representative Mallory. I agree. Our intent is not to create more prosecution or charges for people with mental illness. One of the ideas around this legislation, as opposed to, as Representative O'Neill described, other solutions that we were looking at, was that this would only apply after conviction at the point of sentencing. And so at that point, anybody that had a mental illness or was deemed not guilty by reason of mental illness would already be out of the process before these enhancements went into effect.
Representative Mulray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to clarify, because that isn't enough to satisfy me.
Okay.
In this situation, there's a lot of situations where there's an emotional thing that comes from the things happening in there. I want to exclude those two from being enhanced because I was involved with the other enhancements, and it was always a real intentional, not a sudden emotional thing. And so I hope you not just proven mental illness, but get to that issue too. Thank you.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Neal, I'm just wondering, I'm looking at the definition for patient care zone. And I have a question, but I'm wondering if you would first elaborate in terms of how you came about to define a patient care zone.
Representative O'Neill. Or Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, the intention around the patient care zone was to identify places where patients stay for more than 24 hours. In other words, it's not a short-term event. They're there for a longer period of time, which generally speaking, for healthcare purposes, that means that they're particularly vulnerable. It's a serious enough condition or event that they have to be there for quite some period of time, creating a higher level of vulnerability for the patients, also creating a situation where it's more likely to have visitors that are coming to visit and support their loved ones. So that was the idea around using it for hospitals, long-term care centers, and hospices. Those are all facilities in which people are staying for more than 24 hours. The rest of the definition we tried to mirror after the same definition of property and scope of property that are used for schools, parks, public housing.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative O'Neill, and to the testifiers. So in some circumstances, a person may have a stay of, you know, 1 or 2 days in a hospital and by their own volition elect to fill prescriptions at a site independent of a hospital or a nursing home property, such as a retail established pharmacy in Target, as an example, or a standalone pharmacy, or an urgent care facility, or I'm thinking about ASCs where they might have a circumstance with an adjacent pharmacy. I'm just wondering, not to be derogatory, but why would you exclude those, or are you considering those as the bill moves forward?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, our intention was not necessarily to exclude those. If the legislature feels that they want broader protections, certainly those are areas where patient safety is of significant concern, and where there is, as you mentioned, the issue of drug sales or possessions. At the time that we were drafting this, our concern was that some of those facilities, when the bill goes, presumably, hopefully, goes to judiciary, that some of those areas are more difficult to identify or define for a potential defendant, and so we're worried about claims or accusations that the bill is too broad because it's impossible to know whether or not an office building contains a clinic or a dental office just by the outside exterior, whereas hospitals, long-term care centers, hospices generally have more signage and definition as a campus itself, as opposed to having ancillary or other activities. But that was a limitation that we were trying to create to keep the bill more narrow. We would not oppose expanding it.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think we all want safety for both patients and staff, no matter where they are and no matter who they're serving. I have some real concerns about how this is drafted, and it just feels like it's got a good intention that hasn't been really focused. And, for example, the patient care zone, I agree with Representative Albright that's kind of an interesting sort of set of situations, because it says any property owned, leased, or controlled by a hospital, a hospice provider, or a nursing home where healthcare services are delivered to patients. And so it seems to me that a clinic that's operated by a hospital, hospitals have adjoining outpatient clinics, same-day surgery centers. As we're getting to more integrated healthcare, I think it's going to be harder and harder to define what this patient care zone is. And I think for people who are living down the block from a residential hospice, and some of them are very small and are located in residential settings. They're just a house on the block with some extra sort of provisions and stuff. To have signs that say this is, it can send the wrong message to the public too, that this is a dangerous zone, that we're worried about drug dealing, we're worried about guns, we're worried about all kinds of things. And so I think you may have some unanticipated consequences by describing this so broadly, I think you're bringing in visions to us of, you know, outside the door of HCMC. Well, there's no housing nearby on those blocks. It's a very different circumstance when you have a nursing home across from a park, for example, in my district, with houses right next door and across the street from it. And, I mean, I think there's, you know, and I haven't heard, you know, that the nursing home industry or the hospice association or other people have said this is a problem they want to have addressed. So I would really like you to have a lot more support than just the hospital association. The other thing I'm wondering about is whether or not you have any evidence that this has worked in the zones that we're currently posting these signs, and we've had this kind of policy for a while, and you know, maybe it works for the drug dealer to think, I don't want the higher penalty. They might even actually know what it is. But I think most people who are in a fit of passion or anger or frustration, you know, hit someone, they don't know what the penalties are in the current law, let alone the enhanced ones. So I'm trying to understand why you think this would be an effective response as opposed to some other sort of strategy you could use to enhance your worker and patient safety.
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative, as I said before, I think the Hospital Association and our members would agree that this isn't going to solve all the problems, and this isn't going to be that there are limitations around public policy around how much you can affect this sort of thing, and that our focus in working with the Department of Health and the rest of the coalition is really around trying to keep our focus and attention on those kind of preventative efforts around de-escalation training, around responses. Those are things that we are doing. Ms. Meister testified about the examples just in Buffalo, but that is just one example of stuff that's going on all around the state, and we intend to continue that, largely because these events are going to happen and continue to happen, so we want to take those very, very seriously. With respect to your other questions about the definitions of the zones, we will take that into consideration and consider revising that. If you want something more narrow or more narrowly focused, we would certainly be open to doing that, and we've reached out to the Hospice Association, Leading Age of Minnesota, and Care Providers, and we will bring back their responses. I don't want to speak on their behalf, but would be happy to bring back to their responses as well.
Representative Loffler. Well,
Madam Chair, this is the Health and Human Services Policy Committee, and if we're being asked to make policy related to those other health care facilities, the place for that testimony is here. The Hospice Association, the long-term care people should be here saying, yes, we want to be in this bill. This because the Public Safety Committee isn't responsible for what happens in health care zones. Nor do they know the complexities of the different definitions of healthcare facilities. And so I'm reluctant to impose something upon entire industries across the state that are not here at the table saying this is a solution they want, this is a solution that they've discussed with their neighbors, with their city, because it does send a chilling message when you put up signs around a facility. It sends a different message within the facility. And so I think it's important that we do that. If our goal is to protect people, though, I think it's interesting that rape is not on your list of terrible things that can happen to people. And I know that I've known women who work on the overnight shift at hospitals who have told me that they are at great risk and have been told to be particularly alert because people who are looking for for that kind of victim know where women are late at night, and they're disproportionately female workforces. So if you thought it would work, you know, that might be something you think about. And the last thing I really do want to reinforce what Representative Mullery said, which is in our state to be not guilty, and I'm not a lawyer, he is, but to be found not guilty by reason of insanity is a really high standard. We have one of the highest standards in the nation. And so someone acting out of either a short-term mental health issue or a long-term one, that's not necessarily going to hold weight against this when you put it before a prosecutor. And I think especially in our caregiving facilities, we should not make the patient feel like just being themselves is a risk of being thrown into jail. And I have met with many people with severe mental health issues. I went to one facility that a constituent of mine works with, and they told me story after story of how when they go to the emergency room with a medical condition, people see it on their chart that they're mentally ill, and they throw them up to the mental health ward. And one woman, it took her 6 hours to say, but I have not had a bowel movement in 2 days. I'm in pain. Can you help me with that? And because they just saw that, and they saw her agitated, and they said, okay, this is where you go. And so I can see where they get to a point of tremendous frustration sometimes because they're labeled and not always heard in the circumstance in which they find themselves. And I can just say from a personal situation and I was surprised that this was a roommate situation in a hospital, but a woman was being removed from ventilator support. And her family was there. It was clear from the family, and they were a very loud, raucous family, that there had been different feelings about making that choice. And it's a very tough choice that none of us want to be involved in. This woman did not die right away. They came in bringing in painkillers for her, and they're going, wait a minute, they told us she doesn't experience any pain. The family was legitimately very upset and very agitated, and you know, we asked for our family member to potentially be moved because she was going through something that I didn't think she needed to hear all this drama. But at the same time, if someone in that family had totally lost it, I would hate to see them thrown into jail because of inadequate communication and being confronted with a situation that none of us wants to confront. And so I think it's a much more complicated situation than this bill portrays, and I don't think it's ready to move on out of the Health and Human Services Committee, which is responsible for the care of patients and making sure that our staff are safe. I am totally into staff safety. But I don't think this necessarily gets us here, and I don't think it's ready to go to a committee that trusts us to have really wrestled with these issues. And from the patient's perspective, from the worker's perspective, from the neighbor's perspective, and what types of facilities this needs to apply to. So, Representative O'Neill, I'm sympathetic to the issues you're trying to work with others in solving. I just think it needs a lot more work before it leaves the jurisdiction of this committee.
And Representative O'Neill, I can let you respond to that. Just a couple of comments. I do think in terms of the other folks involved in this bill, long-term care, some of the groups that were referenced in Loeffler, Representative Loeffler, excuse me, that you referenced in terms of buy-in, I'm assuming just like all folks that follow things closely here on the legislature, if they had strong opposition to being included in this, they would be here, certainly would have contacted Representative O'Neill. A lot of times here at the legislature, the absence of not being here to testify against lends itself to think that they, at the very least, don't mind being included in this bill. And in addition, I think what this bill is trying to get at is saying, you know, if you're in a place where there's vulnerable people and staff who are putting themselves in very vulnerable situations, the work that they're doing, the close contact that they're in with patients, that there should be heightened consequences. And I'm sure that in the court of law, if somebody is mentally unstable or there are findings that would lend themselves to think that this person was insane, on some level, that there are allowances for that, that you're not making felons out of those folks, that they find the proper treatment that they needed, just as in any other case of a felony or where an offense would be. And so I think what this bill is trying to really zero in on is that in these cases where staff people are put in particularly vulnerable situations, we need to have extra protections and extra penalties, and people should be aware of that. And so I think it lends itself well. There maybe is some work that needs to be done between here and public safety just to make sure that you are getting at it in the way that, you know, we want to, and take some of the concerns into consideration, Representative O'Neill. But I think raising awareness to what the staff people in some of these facilities are dealing with is important. So, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Loeffler. I really appreciate all your comments and your concerns, and we'll absolutely take those. And I actually was with the long-term care people this morning in two bill hearings myself. And so I am in contact with them, and they haven't said anything to me yet, but we will all check back with them again and clarify that, and I'm more than willing to work on this between now and public safety. And I serve on the public safety committee, and so I understand the components that they'll be dealing with. We still haven't asked for public testimony, so maybe there's public testimony that would address some of your concerns about long-term care, hospice care, and so on. If anyone has objections to being added to that, we can certainly ask for that as well. But I have not been contacted by anybody, and like I said, I did have them testify with me this morning.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Is there anyone from the audience who wants to testify for or against this bill? Okay, I'm seeing none at this point. So with that, members, I will renew my motion that House File 1088 be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Crime Prevention. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the committee is re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. Thank you, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Members, next we have House File 575, Representative Grunhagen. And Representative Grunhagen, I will move that House File 575 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Welcome to the committee. And I don't have any amendments for your bill, Representative Grunhagen. So if you want to introduce your bill, and then we'll go to testifiers.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to present House File 575. What it would do is modify payments to the 17 federally qualified health centers in our state and 83 rural health clinics for patients they serve that enrolled in both Medicaid and Medicare. These patients are known as dual eligibles. They are very low-income seniors who are eligible for Medicare due to their age and eligible for Medicaid due to their income. Prior to January 1, 2012, providers that served dual eligibles received 80% of the Medicare payment rate from the federal government, and 20% patient copayment was paid by the Department of Human Services here in Minnesota. Starting in January 1, 2012, the state no longer provided the 20% copayment on behalf of the patient, although there were two exemptions to this policy. One was payment for mental health services, the other payments for dialysis services provided to end-stage renal disease patients. These low-income seniors typically do not have the 20% copayment. Therefore, the federally qualified health centers and the 83 rural health clinics provide the care as uncompensated care. HF 575 would do two things. It would add federally qualified health centers and rural health centers to the list of exempted providers under statute. Number two, it would provide reimbursement to them at their Medicaid payment level, known as the prospective payment. With me today is Jonathan Watson from the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers to further explain the bill.
Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you. My name is Jonathan Watson. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. I represent the 17 federally qualified health centers here in the state of Minnesota that serve 180,000 low-income patients. I'm here to testify in support of House File 575, and I'd like to thank Representative Grunhagen for introducing the bill. According to our estimates, FQHCs in the state serve roughly 2,100 low-income seniors who are duly eligible for Medicare and Medicaid. Obviously, they're very low income, and as Representative Grunhagen alluded to, they probably cannot afford the 20% copay that is imposed upon them at this point. Since FQHCs, we serve all regardless of their ability to pay, this simply becomes another source of uncompensated care for our 17 FQHCs. It's very difficult given our patient base, that only 15% of our patients are privately insured, to cost shift any losses to that narrow portion of our patient base. Moreover, this policy does impact the state's 83 rural health clinics, as Representative Grunhagen alluded to. I do not represent, nor does my association represent, the rural health clinics in the state. However, they are kind of cousins of ours. They look a lot like us, and they do serve the underserved in Minnesota, especially in greater Minnesota. From a clinical perspective, the rationale for House File 575 really relates to the fact that many of the dual eligibles have higher prevalence of chronic diseases, such as pulmonary diseases, heart disease, and diabetes, compared to non-dual eligible Medicare folks. So the current 20% copayment may deter some of these individuals from engaging in primary care. These are the last people that should really be foregoing primary care for folks with chronic conditions. So House File 575 would really strike down a barrier and increase access to care for low-income seniors. House File 575 would also pay FQHCs and our rural health clinics their legally prescribed Medicaid rates, which is higher than simply adding that 20% back in. I want to be clear about that. Our rationale for this ask is twofold. These patients are Medicaid patients, and per federal law, if they use an FQHC or a rural health clinic, they do trigger this prospective payment rate. And secondarily, there is a communication from the federal government, the CMS agency, to our Department of Human Services, that does specifically spell out this payment. Now, this is subject to some debate with one of our health centers and the department, and it's unresolved at this time. Nonetheless, we've been working with the department with this, and we've also had a conversation with them about implementation of House File 575. They do have some concerns about the implementation, and I assured them I'd work with them to continue the conversation as we move forward. So, in the meantime, I would appreciate the committee's support, and I can stand for any questions at this time.
Members, any questions? And I'll ask, too, is there anyone in the audience who wants to testify in favor or against the bill? Okay. Representative Grunhagen, good work.
Brevity is the key to effectiveness, so I think I'll keep my mouth shut.
Okay. Well, with that, members, I will renew my motion that House File 575 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
And Representative Grunhagen, you can stay right where you are. Your next bill up is House File 1277. And so I will move that House File 1277 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
And Representative Grunhagen, I understand that you have an author's amendment, the A2 amendment.
Yeah, this is a Peace in the Valley amendment with the that applies to the Minnesota Academy of Physician Assistants. They wanted this to be attached, and we were amenable in order to do that. So, Madam Chair, I can't move the amendment, can I?
No, I will move the amendment for your Representative Grunhagen, and we'll put it on so that we can get the bill in the order that you would like to discuss it, and then we will go on to the presentation of your bill. So, members, I will move that that we move the A2 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Representative Grunhagen, to your bill as amended.
Well, members, I believe this is a very important bill. It has to do with a task force report. You have a little bit of a copy of it in your packet or of information that you have. And this is simply the next step from this task force on foreign-trained physicians. I think most of us realize, being in the HHS committees, that we have a crisis building in terms of shortages of doctors and medical personnel across the state of Minnesota. One of the things I've learned in dealing with this bill, and I haven't read the whole report, but there is that part of that shortage is self-inflicted, members. Okay, between the federal government having limited residency spots and the state of Minnesota having a five-year rule, which I understand there will be representatives to address some of that, we basically created a difficult time for medical professionals to enter the profession and also to expand it in many cases. And so this creates an additional pathway for those immigrant doctors that have come here to be vetted and trained, and not in any way lowering the bar for our medical professionals, but on the other hand, making sure that they're competent to deal with the citizenry, whether it be in our inner city, rural areas, or in the metro area in general. At this time, Madam Chair, with your permission, I'd like them to stand. I think there's a few of them here just to be recognized.
Thank you for taking the time to be here. Representative Grunhagen.
And like I like to do with all immigrants, we were all our parents and grandparents were at one time immigrants. We're all children of immigrants that came over to this country for a better life. And that's what they're here to do, too. Plus, they give us the added advantage of being able to address this shortfall we have as far as medical coverage is concerned. There's three main goals in this bill. The first is to create a statewide council on international medical graduates. Number two, provide support services to prepare immigrant physicians to navigate the steps to licensure. And number three, explore new licensure options for immigrant physicians and make recommendations to the legislature. With that, I will turn it over to my testifiers to give their perspective on this bill.
Welcome to the committee. If you could just introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony, and we're asking testifiers to keep it to 2 to 3 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I think Representative Grunhagen did a great job in explaining the bill. I just want to add a little bit to some of the things the task force found. The task force found that in Minnesota we have an estimated 250 to 400 unlicensed immigrant doctors in the state. And these doctors come from the same communities as a lot of the immigrants, and they're not fully represented in the workforce. We've also found that integrating these doctors could result in significant cost savings to the state, including expenses associated with preventable hospitalizations and chronic disease. So this would be a solution to not only the physician shortage that we have, but also to some of the high costs of medical care. I'll just sit back and answer any questions if necessary. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And if you wouldn't mind just saying your name on the record.
I'm sorry. My name is Yende Anderson, and I'm the Executive Director of New Americans Alliance for Development. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Madam Chairperson, committee members, and ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to speak here. My name is Mimi Wu, and I am a physician from Burma, and I'm a Burmese American. I'm a citizen, a U.S. citizen. I had a thriving practice in Burma, but I followed my parents to become an immigrant. I followed as an immigrant, and I came here, and then I went out again to Uganda, and I went to Uganda as a UN physician because I obtained a job as a UN physician, and I work as a WHO consultant, having a patient population about 2,000, looking after all the expatriates as well as the compatriots. And after the, it was a very challenging situation, but I served as a UN physician. And I received a combined letter of recommendation from 7 UN heads of agencies, which was the first in the history. And when the contract ended, I came back to the United States, and I took the United States medical licensure exams, the USMLEs that the American medical graduates have to take. And I passed these exams. And for me to take the USMLEs, I have to have gone to a school that is recognized by the World Health Organization. If the school that I went to is not recognized by the World Health Organization, I am not even allowed to take the exam. I just wanted to explain that the situation. So I did apply to residency. I had 13 years of clinical experience, but I did not get into a residency. I was told that I, in spite of having 13 years of clinical experience, as well as working for the UN, I did not have the clinical experience in the US. And also, the year that I graduated from medical school in Burma was too long ago, even though I took the exams, the same exams that the American medical graduates have to take. So I did not get into a residency position. But, well, I have a family to look after, and I have an autistic child too, so I had to work. Any position that I could get. I became a phlebotomist in a hospital. And also, I work as an medical interpreter because I speak Burmese and I speak English. I work for several interpreter agencies, including the Center for Victims of Torture. And almost all the clients that I met, they all asked me, why can't you be our doctor? You pass the exams, why? Well, I don't know. I mean, I passed the same exact exams, and this is what I faced. Anyways, when I first started, the population of the Burmese people was not that much, but according to the Current Organization of Minnesota and the Office of Refugee Resettlement, now there are about over 8,000 Burmese people from Burma. I won't say the Burmese, I mean they're all Korean, I mean several ethnic groups from Burma are here. And they are in St. Paul and in other rural areas like Worthington, Wilmer, Austin, etc. in the rural areas. People from Burma are one of the groups, one of the diverse groups also. And as any diverse group, they contribute towards health disparities also because they don't understand the system and they don't understand the language. So they contribute towards disparities. I just wanted to say one thing that, I mean, for the patients go to a traditional doctor and see a doctor, it is difficult for them to communicate. They use interpreters, they are helpful. But, I mean, when you don't see somebody, when you see somebody who can speak the language, it reduces a lot of disparities. I just want to give one very quick example. If a Burmese client with high blood pressure go to a doctor and say, and the doctor will ask, have you been adding salt to your food? And the patient will say that no. So, I mean, you will keep on changing medications and saying, why is it not working? But if he went and saw a Burmese doctor, and then the additional question would be, have you been adding fish paste, ngapi? This is the food that you eat all the time. So, of course, yes. Why are you even asking me this question is what they're saying. So, these are the nuances that come with the cultural competency and language competency. So these are the additional bonuses that you will get by integrating internationally trained medical graduates who represent a community. And I just wanted to say also one thing that by integrating these wonderfully talented, highly skilled doctors who speak several different languages, we will be filling the physician shortage. We are willing to go to rural areas because United States rural areas, there's nothing rural for us. There is electricity, water, there are cars, hospitals. So, I mean, believe me, when I was a student, I rode on an ox-driven cart to go deliver a baby. So this is nothing rural. So we are willing to do this. And if you take these doctors in, there is no loan forgiveness. So this is a plus, a win for Minnesota. It's not only one win. There are several wins. Multiple wins, reducing disparities, loan forgiveness, willing to go to rural areas, physician shortage. And also one thing, above all, we are Americans, we are American citizens. It is just that we came at a later stage, like Representative has said. And also, it was an honor for me to serve on the task force. I was one of the members of the task force to reduce the health disparities. And we have several supporters that I'm so proud to say that we are supported by the University of Minnesota and Minnesota Department of Health is a champion who's been helping us out. And others also like the Hennepin County Medical Center, University of Minnesota, Mayo Clinic, etc. So we have several supporters for this bill.
And I'll have to ask you to just wrap up your testimony.
Sorry, yes.
Nope, that's okay.
I will. I just wanted to say very quickly that, I mean, I cannot serve as a licensed physician for the Burmese community. I can serve any community, but I cannot serve as a licensed physician. So I am serving. I am very fortunate to have gotten the 2013 Bush Fellow. So I am a Bush Fellow, and it's almost ending. The last thing that I would like to say is that when someone has the capacity to carry a load of bricks, and if you are carrying only a load of feathers, you are not fulfilling your civic duty towards the society. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much,
Madam
for
Chair.
Your testimony. Representative Grunhagen.
Sounds like we're going to have house calls by doctors again. No, I also have Jim Abel would like to testify.
Okay. Welcome
Thank
to
you.
The committee.
I get to come twice in one day, Madam Chair. Jim Abel representing, Indy is my boss. I represent NAAD, another pro bono client. And you can kind of see how you can fall in love with this group. The people there in the audience represent 200 similar folks that are in Minnesota, most of whom are capable and ready to go to work and serve our underserved populations. This is a work in progress, unfortunately. There was a task force which met all summer long, and Mr. Schoenbaum here, if you have any questions about that, you have, an executive summary of the task force. They were quite thorough. When you have a task force and then you bring forward ideas, sometimes some of those have to fall off. The amendment that you saw took out some of the innovative ideas that we were hoping to do, but still there's a lot of good meat left in the bill. If we can get something done on this, we'll be the first state in the country to accomplish this feat, which is only appropriate. Minnesota should be the leader in this area with 200 doctors and so many talks about health disparities in underserved areas, both metro and in greater Minnesota. This is the kind of bill that I think we can all get behind. Their issues are there's just not enough residencies to go along, and they're not always prepared to handle the rigors of that. But they're, in most cases, highly capable. They've practiced elsewhere already and done a lot of service, so they're ready to go to work. And so just to summarize the bill, if you haven't gotten the big picture, it creates a council, gives tools, and it helps create pathways through residency and other ways that might make sense. It's designed to be a collaborative effort with the different people on the council. You can read the Board of Medical Practice, MMA, the PAs were added, and other groups who are interested in helping this to come to fruition. When the dust settles on this, if we can get these 200 folks in the pipeline, we'll have done something remarkable. So I urge your support, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, there's one more testifier, Madam Chair, with your permission. Becky Ness with the Physician's Assistant. And while she's coming up, I just want to stress we're not taking any residencies away from any graduates here in the state of Minnesota.
Okay.
This would create an additional pathway outside that. Okay.
Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Good evening. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Becky Ness. I am the legislative chair for the Minnesota Academy of PAs. For those of you who are not familiar with us, MAPA, the Minnesota Academy of PAs, represents the interests of over 1,800 PAs practicing in the state of Minnesota. We are growing. We started with one program. We now have three, and there is a fourth one in the works at St. Scholastica. PAs are one of the recognized professions working to meet the critical health care needs of diverse and underserved populations, and we think that we can definitely work with the proponents of this bill in terms of meeting some of those needs, because much as some of the testimony that you've heard, our profession, by its evolution, is a progression of a variety of medical professions itself, so we kind of understand the barriers that they're facing. When this bill was introduced, there was quite a bit of concern about some of the alternate pathways in terms of the integrity of the education and the admission process for the PA profession in the state. We very much appreciate the amendment adopted as it narrows our concern, and we feel strongly that although there's some language that's still a little bit troubling, we can work collaboratively with the group to meet the needs of all involved. We regret that we weren't consulted on the inception of the bill, but now that we've been invited to join within the discussion, we're hoping to work with the bill's proponents to both ease the international medical graduates to serve Minnesota patients within the communities that are so greatly needed, those underserved communities and in the rural communities, while at the same time assuring that we can do this in a manner that's not disruptive to the existing providers and assures that all of the providers, physicians currently trained in this country, the PAs, the international medical graduates, all continue to meet the excellent standard of care that our patients here in Minnesota expect. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Is there anyone else from the audience who would like to testify? Welcome to the committee. If you could just introduce yourself and then proceed.
Madam Chair, I'm Ruth Martinez. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Medical Practice. We are the state agency that licenses and regulates physicians and a handful of other allied health professionals. First of all, I want to thank the chair and the members of this committee to have the opportunity to comment on this bill as it relates to the licensure of international medical graduates. The Board of Medical Practice applauds the work of the Immigrant International Task Force and appreciates that international medical graduates have some really significant obstacles as they seek professional employment in healthcare settings in Minnesota and across the United States. I should note for the record that the Board of Medical Practice did not have a seat on the task force and did not have a role in developing the recommendations of the task force, even though those recommendations and the legislation that resulted do certainly impact the board and its regulatory processes. Nonetheless, at a joint meeting of the board, its licensure and policy and planning committees last week, members of the board listened to a presentation on the task force's findings and recommendations and reviewed House File 1277 as it was introduced in the legislature. Board members agree that it is desirable to have a diverse workforce that reflects the citizenship of the state of Minnesota, and the board supports recommendations of the task force to invest in better preparing international graduates for clinical training and licensing processes that they will need to undertake in order to practice medicine in Minnesota. Board members believe that gaining entrance to accredited clinical training is a significant obstacle for international graduates, and the board does support recommendations of the task force to invest in creating and securing accredited clinical training opportunities for international graduates. As you may know, the board is charged with protecting the public, and it does so by assuring that applicants meet the credentialing requirements outlined in the Medical Practice Act. The board is not an examining body, it is not an accrediting organization, and it does not have any role or responsibility in evaluating individual clinical skills or in clinical training programs. Accreditation of clinical training is appropriately conducted through the expertise of such organizations as the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education, the ACGME. And the ACGME, in developing and refining accreditation standards over decades, relies on the expertise of a multitude of experts who comprise 27 specialty-specific committees. Accredited clinical training programs are responsible for the training and evaluation of clinical skills of program participants. So really, to close, the board supports several parts of the recommendations, particularly in helping prepare international medical graduates for the processes they need to go through to train and gain licensure. We support creating and funding additional accredited clinical slots for international graduates. The board does not feel that it has the expertise nor the resources to be in the role of serving and accrediting clinical training itself, and that's probably the significant concern that the board has expressed to me at this point in time. The board is taking this issue up again on March 14th at its next board meeting. We'll consider this and any number of other issues that impact our regulatory processes, and the board is really interested in serving a very active role in assessing its own Practice Act, its responsibilities under that Practice Act, and looking ahead to try and address any number of current regulatory considerations that might require us to open and modify any of our licensing requirements. Thank you for the opportunity to comment. I'd stand for questions.
Thank you so much for being here. And members, we will move to questions. I do have a technical amendment that needs to be made, and that is on page 2, line 2.13. Strike 15 and put in the number 16. So just to repeat so everybody can follow along, we're on page 2, line 2.13. I will move to amend the bill by striking the number 15 and inserting the number 16. Are there any questions to that? Okay, all those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Representative Grunhagen, well, actually, first I will say, are there any questions from anyone on the committee? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure if Representative Grunhagen would defer to one of the testifiers on this, but I'm lines 3.17, 3.19, 4.21, 4.22, 4.33, 4.35, 5.17, and 5.18. You are delineating the costing for specific objectives underneath the commission. And the part one of the question is, how did you arrive at the numbers that you hard-coded into the bill, and then given that, what would be an appropriate or an approximate appropriation number given the number of potential candidates you might have to this program?
Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that question, Representative Albright. I thought this was a policy committee, so I wasn't going to answer the fiscal ones. But we do have Mr. Baumbaum. Yeah, Schoenbaum, to address that.
Welcome, Mr. Schoenbaum. And we can, yes, we'll proceed with this question, and then, as Representative Grunhagen said, talk policy stuff. But Representative Mr. Schoenbaum, excuse me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mark Schoenbaum from the Health Department. And last year, when the task force was created, the Health Department was assigned to staff the task force, and we played that role over the summer and fall, worked closely with the many members, and continue to provide that kind of technical assistance. To your question, Representative Albright, the task force developed this range of services that appeared to be needed to increase the probability and the competitiveness of these foreign physicians to make it into residency. It's a surprisingly complex process with many steps. I thought I knew something about all this, and I didn't. There's some, if you want to look at the full report, there are kind of flow charts that cross my eyes. So there are a number of steps that physicians need to go through from kind of an orientation and career guidance, kind of is this really worth their time, or their mind other avenues. So that's a service. And staff and task force members looked around the country. There are similar programs. There's one in Los Angeles. There's one in Boston. Looked at how they operate and what some of their costs are, used that as a model, kind of factored in how many of these folks we think there are in Minnesota, how much kind of it would cost to provide this particular unit of service to so many people. That's how those numbers started to get into the language. Similarly, the bill would proposes to create some dedicated residency slots, a handful of residency slots. As Representative Grunhagen mentioned, there was concern about competing with, for instance, University of Minnesota med school grads. So the university was on the task force and reported out what a residency slot costs per year. So it was those kinds of, that kind of research and calculation that led, I could go on, but that's a...
No, I think, not to belabor the point, I think the point more than anything was just the process that drove the arrival of the numbers, not specifically to the number itself, because that's for finance, as we would understand, but just the process in terms of it wasn't plucked out of the air, per se, but that you're looking at other programs, that you're assessing it based upon the needs of getting these folks ready for the specific, accreditation that they're seeking. So I'm satisfied with that answer, Manager.
Thank you. Representative Mazin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a comment, Mimi is from my district, and as you can tell, she's a strong advocate for this, and I think the frustration in these people having the abilities and talents and not being able to use them is something that is we really should be able to work on. Thank you,
Representative Mazin. I'm seeing no further discussion. Representative Grunhagen, final word, and then we'll vote.
Yeah, just a final comment. Politics is a combat sport. Okay. Yeah. I'd encourage members to look at the full report here if you have time. This idea of shortages of medical personnel and doctors is real. In this particular report, you have 6 different studies estimating in Minnesota our medical care shortages. And the estimates range from 4,000 by 2020 to 850 by 2025 to 803 in 2020. So there's a wide range here, but all the studies pointed to severe shortages going forward, and I think this particular bill and the plan they have is one way to look at addressing some of those shortages. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for considering the bill.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. So, members, I will renew my motion that House File 1277 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails.
Thank you, members.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen, and thank you to all the testifiers for being here. Members, our next bill up is House File 1122, Representative Zerwas.
I acknowledge it. That was my bad. I saw it and I corrected.
Okay, Representative Zerwas. Representative Zerwas moves that House File 1122 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have an 8-2 amendment just to get the bill in the shape which I'd like to discuss it today, if we could move the A2.
Okay, members. Representative Zerwas has the A2 amendment. And if we could just keep the room kind of quiet so members can follow along with what's going on. So we're going to move the A2 amendment to get the bill in the order that the author would like to discuss it. So, members, Representative Zerwas moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Representative Zerwas, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, House Bill 1122, as amended, deals with pediatric home care services and delivering nursing services to a pediatric clientele that would otherwise be not only hospitalized, but within the ICU and hospitals. And these are critically and sometimes chronically ill children that we can serve sufficiently and appropriately by getting them home and with their families. And as someone that has spent a prolonged time down in the cities in the hospital and having a family split where my mom at one point lived at Abbott Northwestern Hospital with me for 5.5 months, and bless her heart, she never went home once in 5.5 months, and my dad commuted back and forth between Elk River and Minneapolis during that period. It can be very traumatic and stressful on a family that's in that type of situation. I know I certainly saw that firsthand. And then the other component to this, Madam Chair and members, is that daily expense of having a child being treated in the ICU for a prolonged period of time is considerably expensive and is really a cost driver for our healthcare system. And so if there are instances where we can treat these folks at home in a much more cost-effective setting. Now, we created this special designation for home care in a previous session, but what we're looking at now is we're having a really difficult time, and we have testifiers that will talk about the difficult time in recruiting the highly technical nurses to perform and provide this type of care. And so what we're looking for is a rate adjustment that would help the reimbursement rate in order to incentivize a higher rate for these specialized ICU nurses in this setting. Even with that incentivized rate structure, the cost to take care of this population at home is still going to be significantly less than if they were to remain in the hospital. With that brief intro, Madam Chair and members, I'll turn it over to a few testifiers.
Thank you so much for being here. Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Susan Wingert. I happen to own a small company that takes care of medically fragile, technology-dependent children in the home called Pediatric Home Service. We're here today to ask for a third tier of consideration for nursing care in the home. 20 years plus ago, they defined two tiers of care, regular and complex. As you can well imagine, healthcare has advanced, and the level of acuity of the patients that we take care of today is much higher than it was 20 years ago. As Representative Zuros indicated, one of our concerns and our problems is that although we are able to recruit nurses to the organization, we cannot retain them because we cannot pay them the amount of money that a hospital can pay them, and that you will find, listening to our testifiers today, that the continuity of care of a child in the home by a nurse who is able to identify crisis situations before they become a crisis improves the quality of care for the child and also reduces the cost to the state. So today I would like to ask you to consider this third tier of nursing so that we can provide to our children a high quality of service and we can provide that continuity of care that they so deserve. I think some of you have met Pat Lang last week, and she is here again today to tell you a little different component of why this third tier of nursing is necessary. And then we're going to introduce you to Dan Ullum, who has a child that not only experienced nursing but graduated from our care. Pat?
Welcome to the committee.
Hi, Madam Chair, committee members. I thank you so much for taking time to listen to my story. In your packet, you have this picture of my daughter in various stages of our awesome life. She is 16. In the first picture, you'll see her surrounded by her medical equipment. She is chronic critical, so she's both. In 2001, she was diagnosed with a rare demyelinating genetic life-threatening disease. She used to be able to play with her toys in the yard, feed herself, and sing like an angel. Now, after two bone marrow transplants and progression of the disease, her breathing is supported by a ventilator. She receives 100% of her nutrition from a feeding tube. She utilizes a wheelchair for mobility because her legs no longer support her, even though she has those fancy shoes on that you see there. She can't walk in them. She's a type 1 diabetic, has had spinal fusion surgery due to severe curvature, and has been in the hospital more Christmases than she has been at home. She is believed to be the oldest living child with this disease, and her doctors attribute it to our zest for life, her positive attitude, and the fact that we manage this disease as if it is invisible in our almost normal home. You can see by her smile in the photo and the handsome male pictures on the wall that she is a happy, fun-loving teenager. The 23 pieces of equipment that you see surrounding her enable her to be home with us and allow me to take her out to church every Sunday, to movies, plays, boat rides with friends, much to the dismay of her doctors, shopping, and many other activities that you and your families can enjoy. Her dependence on many pieces of durable medical equipment does not define or limit us as we continue to robustly live our life at home. I'm a single parent and have worked for over 42 years and currently have nursing in my home 24/7 because of her complicated medical needs. This has not always been the case, and many times for days and nights on end, I would have to balance working and caring for her. I wish I could retire and be home full time, but then I wouldn't be able to pay the bills that I incur. Nursing in my home allows us to live in a more germ-free, familiar, almost normal environment surrounded by family and friends, forgetting about the devastating disease that is our reality. We can sing, we act crazy, we put handsome pictures of boys on the wall, and we even make cookies together. Maddie was most recently hospitalized from November 2013 through August 2014. I worked from the hospital one day a week and in the spacious, beautiful office that you see pictured there. And the rest of the week, I worked my sales territory across the state of Minnesota and Wisconsin. I slept every night in the hospital with her because it was less expensive. And my neighbors and friends took care of the dog and my other daughter. My non-medical expenses for that time period came close to over $4,200 from parking fees, food, and gas, getting back and forth, leaving during the day to go to my job. I'm not pretending for one minute to be Wonder Woman. I'm just trying to paint a picture of a family's life that you may not be familiar with. And to give you a frame of reference from a mother's point of view, on why, I thought I could do it, on why equal pay for home care nurses is critical to hundreds of families like mine. Believe me when I tell you that a nurse in my home has to be even more knowledgeable about things and work equally or more hard than somebody in PICU, and we go immediately to PICU when we go into the hospital. Home care nurses have to deal with many different things, family dynamics, maybe a different living situation than their own. They went to nursing school just like their counterparts and are equally qualified. My current nursing agency requires 40 hours of additional specified training before they enter my home, and then 5 shifts in my home with a preceptor. We have an electronic medical record in my home, which can easily be sent to doctors real time. We have monthly visits from hospital respiratory therapies care managers. There's also an on-call team that's ready to answer any questions that we may have. I live both existences, so I know firsthand that in-home care is not only a better solution, it is a huge financial savings as well. The benefits of a home environment versus a hospital environment can best be seen and heard in person when you see her laugh uncontrollably and smile like there's nothing wrong in the world. In my home, she gets one-on-one care, always. That does not always happen in a hospital, even if she's in PICU. I have lived this life for almost 18 years, and I have never and would never put my child in harm's way. If I didn't truly believe that home care nurses were equally qualified and deserved to be paid the same as other nurses, I wouldn't be here tonight. Don't misunderstand me. We do have excellent care in our hospital as well, and when we need to go there, we go. We are in constant touch with our doctors, and several of them have even made house calls. In fact, they have been so impressed with our handling of life at home that they have nicknamed my home the Chaska PICU, filled with love and panache, equipment camouflaged in zebra print, bright colors, and music 24/7. Unfortunately, though, that is not enough to keep great nurses when they see the hospital pay differential. And I have experienced firsthand the loss of excellent nurses to a hospital because of the inequalities in pay. I can't blame them, but it breaks my heart when we lose consistency of care and we have to start all over, or I have to work during the day and take care of her and work at night and go to work. Life is full of ups and downs. We live it, but this one is one that can be prevented. A nurse is a nurse, no matter where they choose to practice, and should be paid accordingly. Please help me keep the quality of care that we have so Maddie can continue to thrive at home. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for being here and being willing to share your story. It's incredibly compelling. Next testifier.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representatives. I will have a brief, ultra-brief story tonight, just kind of outlining kind of the necessity and the need for consistency and quality of care to keep these kids at home. In your packet, my daughter, I am Dan Ullum, Shelby Ullum's father. My daughter was a former 23-week preemie that was born at 1 pound, 4 ounces. She stayed in the hospital for roughly 10 months. From her first 10 months of her life were in the hospital. She came home and subsequently, after 2 months at home, was admitted for heart issues and ultimately had to be put on, had a tracheostomy and put on a ventilator. She stayed on a ventilator for 3 years at home, and in her first year, one night, one of our wonderful nurses noticed that Shelby wasn't acting really quite right. Her heart rate was spiking in the middle of the night. So subsequently, the 911 was called, an ambulance came, took her down to the hospital, and before we got to Children's, her fever spiked to 105, and she ultimately had a seizure in the ambulance. It was found out that she had a port at this time, and she went septic, and as you well know, septic infections can be deadly to anybody who gets them, and they come on very quickly. So without a quality care provider in the home that can recognize and is there on any single given night on a day in and day out basis that recognizes the symptoms of these kids just like a parent does, is ultimately to keep these kids, you know, thriving and, you know, out of the hospital. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here and sharing your story. It's truly appreciated. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Dr. Roy Maynard. I am medical director of pediatric home service, but I am also a practicing pediatric pulmonologist in Minnesota, and I am also a committee member for the American Academy of Pediatrics on Home Care. I think it's really important to convey to the committee that the numbers of medically complex kids living in our communities has doubled in 10 years, an increasing percentage of those children are being discharged from our children's hospitals in Minnesota with extremely high levels of care. We run little mini intensive care units, as described by the other testifiers, in the home, and we can do that safely as long as we can continue to hire and keep high quality skilled nurses with expanded levels of competencies in the home. It's really important that they have critical decision making. It's important that they maintain consistency of care for these patients. They have the same responsibility and challenges as hospital-based intensive care unit nurses. They just don't get paid as much, and they don't have a code blue button on the wall, and they don't have a hospitalist outside the door that they can scream to when they get in trouble. And without being able to keep these nurses in the home, we're going to increase the morbidities, the mortalities, costly rehospitalizations, and I can assure you, the inability to keep home care nurses is delaying medical discharge of kids from hospitals in Minnesota, and it's costing the state millions of dollars a year. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And before we turn it over for questions, the one thing I want to mention is, as we move throughout the process, one of the things we're having just a slight difficulty with as we look at the, and we'll get to the fiscal side of the next committee, but as we look at that, is taking into account through DHS the actual cost savings that will be realized to MA by getting, you know, many of these kids. Right now the wait list can be in excess of 6 months or longer, and one of the main reasons listed is the idea that they just can't lure in enough nurses just because the pay isn't competitive to what's offered in an ICU in a hospital setting. And so as we look at the fiscal implications of this moving forward, there is a significant cost savings by increasing a reimbursement rate that will result in a higher employability and take down that wait list to get many of these children that are very medically fragile. They need that intensive care, but it's been proven over the last decade that that care can be provided at sometimes as much as a third of the cost at home and not in Children's Hospital or AMBLATS or wherever the other ICU would be for pediatric patients.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. I think that background is helpful to understand the full situation. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm not sure if it's our staff or who could answer this, but you know, we did fairly recently, it might even have been last year, created the category of complex home care nursing, and now we're adding another one, and I don't understand the distinction, at least as it's written here, other than it's pediatric versus adults, but I mean, I know I remember a woman who used to come totally ventilator dependent, pulling her trailer with all the batteries and equipment that she needed, and you know, so this kind of level of need is not limited to children. Medical miracles are happening at all ages, and so I just like to better understand the difference between complex home care nursing and pediatric home care nursing.
Yep, and so I think
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I think the difference is as we talk about the complex home care, and I remember the discussion around that. One of the testifiers saying that category has been in existence for a long time. I think the big thing is the having that category and what the categories look like, and then matching reimbursement rates along with that. And what wasn't touched on was an increase in reimbursement rates. And so I think, and I get where you're coming from, Representative Loeffler. The difficulty is, and we'll be looking at a larger potential for this moving forward. The difficulty, quite honestly, as we've been working with DHS, is we've been unsuccessful as of yet to have DHS give us credit, for lack of a better word, dynamic scoring for any cost savings. Mm-hmm. And so by looking at a pediatric instance of this and taking the family view and keeping a family together that might have multiple children and seeing if we can get that child back. My hope is that when that fiscal note does show up, I am fully convinced that in reality we're going to see a cost savings. Most experts in the field we can get DHS to say, yeah, but we're not going to score it dynamically. And so in order to get something done, we're approaching it with this effort, if that makes sense, Representative Loeffler.
Thank
Representative
you,
Loeffler.
Chair and Representative Roth, I kind of get it that you're trying to do it up first step, but I think we need to look at the definitions because they're so parallel. I don't know if it really works as well as you'd like, and we can work on that later. But I do think that the words are... The other thing I would just comment on and is the amendment that you put on. 25% has to go to patient-specific training. I can understand why people need to be trained effectively to manage these patients, and 50% of the additional goes to the pay and benefits for those nurses. And that leaves 25% potentially to profit or overhead, and we don't usually see those kind of increases since they already are going to get the regular payment rate that covers your, you know, payroll processing, all the administrative stuff you have to do. So I'm questioning what the other 25% and what your expectations are related to that.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler and committee, we are a single company. We would have taken that 25% and put it toward the benefits of the nursing staff. We felt somehow that we were not obliged or able to obligate other agencies to do the same thing. We feel that the nursing staff deserves all of the 75%, and we would, as an agency, put that forward. We would certainly be delighted if the committee would ask us to do that and it became a legislative mandate.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would encourage Representative Zerwas to think about the percentages here, because I think if the real goal is to get the most highly trained, dedicated nurses possible so that you have the outcomes that we all want to see, I think that ought to be the focus.
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, members, no, and I agree, Representative Loeffler. Obviously, we're looking at another potential amendment with some other stakeholders to prepare before finance that would look at a potential study moving forward in conjunction with this to really do a broad-based analysis on what providing intensive care services outside of the hospital and potential cost savings. And so there's that part of the bill that's evolving as well, and we're working with DHS on that. And I will continue to work with the stakeholders involved with this bill, and your concerns have been heard loud and clear.
Members, any other questions on the bill? Representative Schultz.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I just have a quick question. Are these nurses in collective bargaining contracts or not? Thanks.
Okay. Any other questions, members? Okay, seeing none. Representative Zerwas will renew his motion that House File 1122, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. And to the testifiers and people who stayed late to testify, we really appreciate it. Members, next bill, House File 1314, Representative Schumacher. And so I will, Representative Schumacher, will move House File 1314 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. We have the bill before us, and I understand that you have an author's amendment, Representative Schumacher.
Yes, Madam Chair. I would like to move the A1 amendment.
Okay, Representative will move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the order that he would like to discuss it. So, members, with that, all those in favor of the motion signifies by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Representative Schumacher, to your bill as amended.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 1314 is a technical correction bill that would allow qualified University of Minnesota faculty and adjunct members who provide dental services at dental clinics owned by the university to form an agreement with the Department of Human Services and become eligible for electronic health record grants from the federal government. The intent all along was for those providing dental services at the university to be enrolled as an MA provider for these purposes, but because some unclear language in the statute, it currently cannot happen. Under the agreement, the university provider will not receive payment for services provided to MA or Minnesota Care enrollees at the University of Minnesota Dental Clinics. They will not be listed in the MA or Minnesota Care directory, and it is not required to service MA and Minnesota Care enrollees when providing non-volunteer services in a private practice. The language, unlike lemongrass, is to ensure that the agreement is really to utilize the electronic health record grants. But like lemongrass, this bill is good for us. With me to testify today is Mr. Jeffrey Odgen, Chief Administrative Officer for the School of Dentistry at the University of Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee. If you could just introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Ogden. I'm the Chief Administrative Officer for the School of Dentistry at the University of Minnesota. I'd like to thank Representative Schellmacher for moving this bill on our behalf, and I'll be brief since I sense I'm standing between you and adjournment. The School of Dentistry has been partnering with Department of Human DHS for 2 years to facilitate our application to access funds that are available to us under the meaningful use provisions of the Affordable Care Act. This funding applies to three levels of practitioners in the School of Dentistry, our full-time faculty, our adjunct faculty, and our residents, graduate residents, who are individuals who have graduated from dental school and now are pursuing specialty training. So, we in DHS have been taking a very measured approach over the past 2 years to apply for this funding to make sure we do it right. Other states have already moved farther in advance of this. They've already received funding. But we want to make sure that we are totally tight and right for any audit that might come up in receiving this funding. This technical clarification facilitates making our graduate residents eligible for this funding. This provision does not change the scope of practice for these practitioners or any other practitioners in the School of Dentistry. It is very narrow, and it applies only to the School of Dentistry. This provision has no cost to the state. The federal funding is passed through from CMS, administered by DHS, to the School of Dentistry, so there will be no cost to the state for this clarification. We have discussed this clarification with the Board of Dentistry, and they have no disagreement with it. We are unaware of any opposition. Other states and schools across the spectrum have already applied for and followed this process, from Massachusetts to Texas to California, and they have already received funding for their resident practitioners. We see this technical clarification as positive for the School of Dentistry and the citizens of Minnesota. We hope we can count on your support. Thank you for listening, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much for being here, and we are glad that you are here and hung out and are interested in this bill, despite the fact that we're close to adjournment. Yeah. Members, any questions for the testifier or for Representative Schumacher? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the problems that we keep hearing about is dentists who don't take medical assistance or Minnesota Care patients, and maybe it's because they haven't had experience with working with our diverse kind of situation. Does this mean that most of your students will be exposed to serving the kind of culturally diverse, low-income patients that would typically present in MA or Minnesota Care?
Madam Chair,
Mr. Ogden.
Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, thank you for that question. We should be proud of the School of Dentistry and the University of Minnesota. We have the broadest, largest dental program of any dental school in the country, and we have the broadest service network of any dental school in the country. We have 11 clinics outside of the School of Dentistry, and most of those clinics are 70 to 80% public program patients. They are both rural and they are urban. And we still have a long way to go. In fact, we have other legislation to expand upon our rural initiatives to address exactly this point. So one of our missions is to make our students acquainted with a broad cross-section of the patients they're going to serve in their private practice, but we still have more work to do on this.
Great.
Representative Loeffler?
Great. I think that will help us deal with the problem that we keep wrestling with. Some of it is about rates, but some of it is also just about comfort levels.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Members, any other questions? Or I guess first I'll just say, is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify for or against the bill? And seeing no further questions, members, Representative Schellmacher will renew his motion that House File 1314 as amended be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Schellmacher. Members, that concludes our agenda for today. Just a reminder that we will have our next meeting on Friday, March 13th at 10 a.m. With that, members, we are adjourned.